Everyone, I'd like you to take your seats. We are going to get started with the Finance and Administration Committee meeting. Good morning. I'd like to call to order the April 12th meeting of the Finance and Administration Committee. Before you is an agenda for today's meeting as presented. Are there any questions or comments about today's agenda? If not, I'd just like to proceed with the agenda as presented. Next up are the approval of the minutes of March 8th, 2012. Are there any questions or comments regarding those minutes? If not, I would entertain a motion to move the minutes. Moved by Mr. Dyke.
Second.
Second by Mr. Bolger. All in favor?
Aye.
The minutes are adopted. Next up, in terms of action items, is a capital reprogramming request. Mr. Troop will make the presentation.
Good morning. Actually, this is Bill Green. I'll be conducting the presentation. Mr. Troop is here to support me, as Mr. Kubicek. On page 5 of your packets is the beginning of this presentation. Last year, the purpose of the presentation is to request a 1.65% increase to the GM's reprogramming authority for fiscal year 12. That's $14.6 million. This increase is specifically needed to continue work on this Red Line rail rehab phase 1. This is a good news story. We've been accelerating work. There's been a lot of lessons learned over the course of the year, and I'll get into that in just a moment. Last year, this board approved a reprogramming policy change, granting the general manager authority to reprogram up to 5% of the adopted budget, or $44.4 million. The GM has exhausted that reprogramming authority on several projects, which have allowed us to better manage our program and accelerate project delivery on several key projects, and I'll touch on those in a moment. On the Silver Line, Red Line, excuse me, thanks.
We're not that far accelerated yet.
That's why I have Rob here with me. So you can see we've been accelerating work. This is a situation where we had multiple closures on the Red Line scheduled over the course of the year, and rather than come back to locations where we had previously conducted work, what the rail group has been doing is accelerating work into those closures, taking advantage of those dedicated track rights, and performing more work than we had anticipated. So we're proposing to accelerate the work. What this chart shows you is this work is accelerating from fiscal year 13 and fiscal year 14, primarily from fiscal year 14. You're going to see a lot fewer closures in 13 and 14, but primarily in fiscal year 14. You can see the work listed there in the acceleration. All of this funding for this project, the way the reprogramming authority works, is all of this funding for this project has to come from another project, a donor project, if you will. And I'll show you a list of those projects in a moment. But for this project, it's all coming from the Shepherd's Parkway CNG facility. There's been a lot of good work accomplished on the Red Line over this year. We've completed over 12,000 feet of running rail. We've rehabbed 22 escalators, 3 elevators, and installed new air conditioning systems at Union Station. We've completed structural repairs at White Flint and Twin Brook stations and installed 72 new emergency trip station boxes along the system. So with this recommendation, we're asking for approval to increase the GM's reprogramming authority by $14.6 million to complete this work on the Red Line and to maintain the current pace of work.
Thank you, Mr. Green. I believe there are some questions by committee members and Mr. Giancola.
Yes, thank you for the report. If you go back to your restructuring of the Red Line phases, it would be helpful. This is on page 8 of 80, I guess. It's at least in the bottom of mine. It would be helpful if you actually, even though you verbalized the fiscal year's changes, it would be helpful if you tell us what fiscal years those various phases are expected to be in. It just gives me a perspective on the time frame. So, you know, some rough timelines, recognizing you can't give the specific starting completion dates on a lot of the phases. That would be very helpful in a future report.
I'll do so. Thank you.
Are there any other questions for staff? Ms. Bowser?
You mentioned that the authority was coming from the CNG facility.
Yes.
Is that is the CNG facility still being built?
We had initially planned to do three CNG conversions, but now we're doing one.
What's the rationale?
That was directed by Bus. Jack, do you want to speak on that?
Good morning. We had prepared a memorandum to the general manager that was forwarded to the board several months ago that as we developed the fleet going forward, we felt that it was appropriate to have about a 50% split between compressed natural gas and hybrid or diesel, but primarily hybrid, from the standpoint that there's always a concern about a loss of gas as a product. And we wouldn't want to be totally dependent upon the gas. As I say, the gas pipelines that come into this area are numerous, but there is a trunk in the southwest part of the United States where it's just one pipeline that is coming in this direction. And with diesel, if we were to lose supply, there's ample opportunity to find it with compressed natural gas. We really have no other alternatives. We are working at mutual agreements with BWI, Ride-On, and others to provide interagency support for each other, but there really aren't many fueling stations that we can go to if we were to lose the gas. So we felt that a 50-50 split would be adequate. Since Shepherd Parkway is the next facility to be built, we felt that it was the appropriate facility to have the compressed natural gas, and so we've deleted it from the Cinderbed Road and the potential southern facility build-out.
Okay, but this reprogramming only refers to the Shepherd Parkway.
I think what it does is it provides compressed natural gas fueling station at Shepherd Parkway, but the additional funding for the other two facilities is being reprogrammed.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Green? Okay. Before you is a resolution to increase the delegated FY 2012 reprogramming authority for rail rehabilitation Tier 1. I would entertain a motion.
So moved.
Moved by Mr. Downey and seconded by Mr. Nichols. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Okay. The resolution is approved. Next on the agenda is the approval of public hearing staff report, approval of fare change proposal, an update on FY 2013 budget. Before we begin the staff presentation, I know that the committee will have a lot of questions regarding the staff report. I would suggest in this case, because we want to get through the presentations, there are essentially three parts to the presentation that is going to be made today. One will cover the changes in FY 2013 expenditure and revenue forecasts. Second will be a presentation on the public hearing report. And third will be a discussion about changes to the fare structure as well as the 2013 operating budget. I would ask that we allow the staff to make a full presentation on each part. Then we'll break. And then we will allow the committee to debate and discuss or ask their questions with each part in order for the public to get a clear understanding of what is being proposed as well as the committee. So if that is all right with the committee, we'll take that format. Also, I'd like to take this opportunity just to thank members of the public who have provided input into the 2013 budget. I know that, as you'll see in today's presentation, many members of the public have submitted their feedback via our online survey, through written testimony, and through our public hearing. So I'd just like to take this opportunity to thank them for taking the time and effort to let the board know what their concerns are and their comments regarding the FY 2013 proposed budget. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Green to make the staff presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm on page 19 now of the presentation, the purpose. We'd like to present to you some ideas for further expenditure reductions. I'd like to give you a revenue forecast update with new economic conditions based on the Moody's April forecast. And then Barbara Richardson will be going over the public outreach report. And then based on input we received at those hearings and also feedback we received from the board over the last couple of months, we've got some ideas to recommend the changes to the GM's proposal and then discussion about the fair implementation schedule. Just to remind you, where we were at the beginning of this process was we had estimated a $119 million budget shortfall. That was comprised of $3 million lower revenues as compared to 2012 and a $116 million expenditure increase. So we were starting from a point of $119 million. We're here today to talk about some expense reductions, some proposed expense reductions, and you can see on this chart we've identified a combination of expense reductions and funding reductions, recognizing the action the board took last month to accelerate the funding for the Bus Plus initiative. That's $2 million. You can see it asterisked there. Transit security funding, we're anticipating $1 million for continuation of federally supported grants. And administrative expenses, this is a procurement initiative where we're looking at some more master sourcing of contracts, looking for efficiencies in that area. Those savings will be recognized across the organization and also some savings in contracted services. And finally, the access contract savings. This is not a reduction in service. This is no changes to the service. What this is a recognition of our actual cost structure that we're experiencing this year. We're 9 months into the year now. We have a pretty good idea of where we are. Let me talk briefly about the update to our revenue forecast now. We've got the Moody's projections in now for April. You can see here that jobs in the district, which is a very prime predictor for our rail ridership and rail revenue, you can see that when we were here, the dotted line indicates the forecast from November. We actually had a slight uptick, and now the projection is very flat from that point forward. So that's a somewhat positive indicator. Prior to the forecast, the economy had been outperforming the forecast. The private sector hiring in business services and healthcare are up. Housing is also outperforming expectations. The federal spending cuts under the Budget Control Act of 2011 will certainly weigh on the economy as the federal payrolls are reduced. We're really not sure where those will occur. We know that they'll occur, but not where. DC jobs in proportion to all metro jobs are most accessible to metro rail stations. Next slide, please. Another key variable, particularly in both bus and in rail, is DC population. And that's the back one, please. Thank you. Population growth in 2011 was the best in decades. Beginning in 2009, there were strong inflows of domestic migrants. And they began flocking to the region, taking jobs. With the public sector scaling back, you can see the trend is actually the growth is starting to dissipate, and the line is not quite so accelerated. D.C. population, the rate of growth has slowed, but it's still relatively strong. A lot of young people coming in and renting. Rental units are decreasing. The availability is decreasing. Commercial real estate, however, will be impacted by tighter fiscal conditions in the next year and a half. Bus is more influenced by employment, actually, than by population, than employment. One of the other prime indicators is the construction jobs, the graphic on the left. This is a key indicator for our bus ridership and for our bus revenues. Construction jobs have actually flattened out. The earlier projection from November anticipated a greater decline associated with the completion of the various stimulus jobs around the region. And some of the private sector activities actually picked up a little bit of that slack. So you can see it's really a flat projection. And then the hotel rooms sold, very little change from the last forecast, a prime indicator for our tourism trade. Overall, I categorize this as very flat. The projection's flat, slightly better than the downtick that was predicted last time, but overall a flat projection. We put some gas prices in here for you. Gas prices can often influence transit ridership, so we We just thought we'd show you where the comparison between the two forecasts. So you can see we've all been experiencing spikes in the gas prices, and then they anticipate that those levels to come back down to about where it was projected earlier this year, in November, I should say. So what our models tell us when we feed all of this input into our models is that we have a very conservative forecast here. What it's saying is, if you look, there's three columns portrayed here, starting from the leftmost. This is the 2012 forecast. This is where we anticipate we're going to end the year. We have 9 months of actuals in, so we're projecting 3 months ahead. We feel very very good about this forecast with only 3 months remaining. The middle column was the forecast from November of 2011, based on the variables we talked about earlier. And you can see on the right the updated forecast for April based on the Moody's information that we received. I'd like to draw your attention to the, if we look on the ridership, under the 2012 forecast, it was about $353 million. It took a dip in the 2013 proposal in November, and now we're almost precisely back, or we're almost precisely where we're going to end up 2012. Our 2013 forecast is almost precisely where we're going to be in 2012, so it's very flat ridership across the region. However, the $11 million increase is a comparison to the earlier forecast, to the most recent forecast. Revenue, same situation. We're seeing about a $9 million increase as a result of these new riders and also as a result of running all of these economic variables through our models. So what does this mean? We started at 119. I gave you the $7 million in expenditure reductions, so that took us down to 112. Now when we look at the impact of this new revenue forecast, you can see it's another favorable move of $9 million. We're now at $103 million delta.
Thank you, Mr. Green. We'll stop right here, and we'll entertain any questions or comments from the committee this time. Ms. Hines.
Thanks, Mr. Costa. Mr. Green, just so I'm 100% clear, if you go back one slide. When I'm looking at the fair revenue projections that you've put on the table, this is built on the manager's fair proposal. Is that correct?
This is the base.
This is the base. So this
does not include the fair changes.
Okay. So the fair changes will play out on this larger ridership,
yes,
and result in something, but that $9 million is just
on the base.
On the base. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Green? Mr. Bulger.
I'm assuming in the earlier slides that you're not getting the model just for the District of Columbia. This is for the region.
Some of the indicators and factors in our model are specifically focused on the District of Columbia, jobs, for example. Some of the other variables are regional variables, but the key variables, population and jobs, are focused on the district. Those are the most closely aligned indicators that we've found at the performance.
Clarify, because Bill is right. We look at, it's the biggest indicator that links what our commuters do, right? So they come out from the suburbs into jobs, and so into the district, and then the other way. And so the biggest indicator that links to what our ridership is has always been historically population and jobs in the district. And so we have a historic relationship with that. Doesn't mean we look at other variables. We look at others as well, but that's a primary one.
I'm sort of surprised, since Tyson's Corner, for example, is the second largest employment center in the region next to downtown. And is that getting captured in this model, or as Silver Line comes on? Okay, the other question I had, Marcel, if I could, is we've been cheered by the increase in Metro bus ridership over the last couple quarters. And if you look at the Metro bus revenue, it really didn't jump up very much on the base. Is there a correlation between good news on ridership and flat revenue on Metrobus? Let me just get back that slide. I'm on page 27 of 80.
I'm there. Originally, with the 2013 proposal, you can see that we had projected lower revenue, I should say, than what we're actually what we've actually experienced. And I think over the course of these deliberations, there's been a lot of discussion about that correlation between the very positive bus ridership. I think 12 consecutive months we've exceeded projections. So we're factoring that increased ridership and actually a better ability also to capture the number of riders that we're carrying into this forecast.
Doesn't show up, though, on the revenue side.
It shows up in terms of the revenue is relatively flat, and I think that's a function. When I say relatively flat, I'm comparing the 2012 forecast of 132 million riders to 131, and then revenue is going up slightly from a projected 132 million down at the bottom part of the chart to 133 million. So when we ran all of these variables through the model, it does also have an impact on the base on the average fare per rider. So reflected in that is the fact that we're doing a much better job now of capturing the riderships as we've migrated roughly 85% of our riders are now using bus passes, Smart Trip. We have much better indicators of ridership, and then the transfers also have been moved to Smart Trip. So we're factoring in that higher ridership than we had traditionally forecast.
But not revenue.
Revenue's up. I think revenue's up proportionally. It's up about $1 million. And so what I'm projecting is very flat revenue and ridership for bus across the 2012 actuals to 2013 revised projection.
Are there any other questions? Ms. Bowser, then Mr. Nichols.
Also on that slide, you show the an FY12 to FY13 ridership change in Metro Access.
It's very
ridership increasing, but the revenue goes down?
Very slightly goes down.
Well, it's $400,000.
Right.
Why is that?
That's a good question.
Okay. It would, just if we could get some clarification on that, that would
I'll
be
I'll get
helpful.
That back to you later today.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Nichols.
Actually, Mike, first off, thank you for the qualitative refinement in the revenue forecast. That's very important and very helpful. I think maybe my questions I'll reserve until a little later. I'm particularly concerned about discussing the out years in terms of the implications of now and into 13, into 14 as well. And I think we want to have a robust discussion around where we will be there because our challenges mount then, and we don't want to get too rosy a picture of what the realities are going to be, and that's my concern.
We'll cover that towards the end. Are there any other questions, Mr. Downs?
Could you remind me what the bus ridership increase has been for the last 12 months?
We're projecting to build about 132 million riders this year. I'll have to get you the precise. I believe it was around 8 or 9%.
I think it's closer to 12. But
I think some of the months were 12, but Mr. Requa, do you have those numbers?
I believe our ridership increase has been in the 10 to 12% over the last year. Some of that is a result of technology improvements in collecting the information, and at least half of that we believe is increased ridership. Last month, March, I think we saw an increase of about 100,000 over last year, 10.5 or 11.5. So it's still going up. It did seem to slow down in March as our comparisons to last year from a technology standpoint probably are more accurate.
The reason I raised the issue is that there is a trap in forecasting no increase in bus ridership, which means that you're not planning for increases in ridership, both in terms of bus capacity and staffing. I worry about turning a blind eye to what's actually happening with bus ridership. I think it's all right to be conservative about fiscal estimates. It's prudent. From an operational planning and resource needs, if demand for bus is growing almost 10% a year, making a forecast that it's not going to grow at all in the next fiscal year doesn't seem to make a lot of sense about the resources necessary to be on the street to meet that demand, is all.
Well, I will say that I think you make a valid point. The ridership projection really reflects what we're seeing now, the increase, the 10%. That's the projection that we're forecasting for FY13. And it is a combination of things. Historically, we have had a very difficult time capturing actual ridership on bus because we've had paper transfers, all sorts of ways that we don't really capture a rider. And if you look at the past ridership numbers, they probably were not as accurate as they should have been. With the event of eliminating paper transfers, with the advent of all the actions that we've taken over the last several years, and with the advent of people using more smart trip cards, you're not now reliant on a bus driver to actually tap a button on the fare box to make sure that that rider is recorded. I would say that because of that automatic electronic data capability that we have now, we have a more accurate reflection of what ridership really is. And so coupled with the fact that we do have an increase in ridership that we're reflecting this year, which is reflected of the economy, the urban environment, and people actually taking surface transportation more, we feel that the estimates that we have appropriately project what we think we're going to see. I do think that we have an opportunity to take a look at it in FY14 and 15 in order to accommodate the remarks that you've just made about growth.
I appreciate all of the advances that have been made that allow us to get a more accurate count. But a lot of those are older than 12 months in terms of comparison. If you look at month-to-month increases, they're way past having a benchmark that is pre-smart trip card penetration levels that we've got now. And I think I've suggested several times that it's really important to understand from an analytic standpoint what's actually happening with bus. I believe it's the fastest growing service that the authority provides, and we're acting a bit like it's not actually happening. And I think it drives demand on capital and both capital and operating funds going forward. And I think we need a better framework for making decisions about bus going forward.
Well, I will say, too, and I appreciate that, I will say that the new service that we have is reflected in those ridership numbers. So to your point about the resource required, we have planned for that in FY13 already.
Are there any other questions? Okay. If not, we'll proceed to the next part, which is the public hearing outreach staff report. I believe Ms. Richardson is going to make the presentation.
Good morning. As the chair mentioned, we had a lot of comments from customers and the public, and this was much more expansive, certainly, than last year. We had over 4,000 comments come in, and I will say over a month-long period, and I will say that they're continuing to come in. So my comments and report are based upon the actual official period of comment was a little over a month. But we received suggestions, comments, questions in a number of ways, letters, emails, calls, the public meetings that you all attended as well, and on our online survey. In fact, which I'll get into a little bit in more in depth, but the online survey, there were four times more participants this year in the survey than there were last year. So we're very encouraged by that. We also did an open forum with Metro Access, so there were some new things that we did, too, to help increase the amount of comments where our customers through Metro Access were called in comments to a special open forum line. And at the hearings, you'll recall that we use this opportunity not just for budget comments, but to also explain our work that we have underway, also a little education about Metro Forward. We had staff available at tables during the open forums. We also, recognizing that we are aggressively recruiting new staff, that we had the human resources staff there. And we also offered a cyber cafe where we helped customers and participants fill out our online survey. I think that the extensive input has, there are many factors for it, but we certainly did a lot of outreach this year. We published the legal notices in six different languages. We advertised extensively. We used our website, which is our number one tool to reach customers. We had signs in the stations on our buses, in the trains. We had posters. We had banners. And we also used our extensive outreach network with stakeholders, over 1,400 organizations that we keep in touch with. So it was pretty extensive notification process. Next slide. On the hearings to report, we had attendance of 270, 124 individuals actually commented. And it would range from public members of the public, transit advocates, stakeholders. We also heard from council members. Council member Mary Che testified. We also welcomed back former board member Chris Zimmerman when he participated in Arlington. We had commissioners from the ANC, so lots of participation there. The majority of the comments in the hearings were focused on the Metro Access fares, and this plays out also in some of the written comments I will also report on. The comments were really twofold, advocating for a lesser fare increase than what was proposed, as well as comments about the fare structure, asking that we revisit in the simplification of that fare structure. Service quality, in short, if customers were saying and participants were saying, if we're paying more, we'd like to have we want better service reliability. So there were comments about service delivery. And I would also say that the third bullet there speaks to you have a lot of work going on, so there certainly should be an expectation about face-to-face service delivery as well. Help us. Give us more information, provide a little more service, extend yourself a little bit more, because we're extending ourselves a little bit more during this process. Funding sources, we heard rather than raise our fares, we would like the jurisdictions to pay more. That's what we want. Don't ask us for any more, but others should contribute. Metro should tighten up, should contain costs. Heard a number of comments about the expectation that our employees should be paying, for instance, for pension contribution. Also, organizational inefficiencies were highlighted, people asking for us simply to tighten belt, look at contracts, etc. And then in general, of course, over all of it was comments on different parts of the fares. But in general, those that showed up did not want to pay higher fares. I think it's safe to say. Next slide. Those that submitted written comments, again, the over a third of what we had come in were related to Metro Access, same theme, not an increase in look at the fare structure. Probably close to a quarter of them was do not increase fares at all, although some people did say, yes, increase the fares, make it better. I'll pay more, but make it better. Alternate savings, looking again, you know, Metro, you need to do a better job at saving money. Look for better ways to save. Also, there's comments about this, the paper card and opposition to charging added fee on the paper card, although
There was significant discussion about the use of paper fare cards, which I'll get to on the online survey, so that does not match with the comments that we saw in the survey. And then in the hearing process, I would say that there was more, if bus customers were going to comment, it was in the hearing process about the reluctance or opposition to bus fare increases, but not overwhelmingly, as you can see there. So for the online survey, as I mentioned, four times the amount of participation that we've seen in the past. One of the first things I would highlight, and I know there's been a lot of discussion about it, is the elimination of the peak of the peak fare. We also used this survey, before I get to that, to have conversation with customers and the people who participated in the survey about policy questions, too. And I'll get to that. But I think that this survey, not just related to this specific budget, but the findings and the comments that we heard would be helpful to the strategic planning process that the board has undertaken. And that's the way that we structured it. We did not want it just to be about the fare proposals. So 57% favor eliminating peak of the peak. Of those, I would say, though, of those that said keep it in place, 80% of those said keep it at the same level. So if they were saying, no, leave it alone, retain the revenue, they were saying leave it alone and leave it exactly at the same level. Don't increase my fare. There was a lot of discussion about the use of paper fare cards, as I mentioned. Almost 80% support the surcharge on the paper fare cards. This really does track with input that we've heard previously from customers, certainly in focus groups. There's a lot of frustration with, the boarding on buses, transaction time through the fare gates. People have a high level of frustration about the use of the paper card when the smart trip card is faster. So I wasn't surprised to see that result, because that carries a theme that we've heard before. A small number said that that the fare should be equal, about 18%. And continuing on our efforts to move almost all the customer base to Smart Trip, 18% said we should eliminate cash altogether and eliminate paper fare cards altogether. When we looked at the different options around should we charge a dollar surcharge or should we do the $4 and $6 zone fares that we had talked about, 44% of them favor charging some surcharge on the paper card versus going to $6 and $4, although a third of them said that that would be fine with them too. So there were a third of them that said that. Parking, overwhelmingly charge more for parking. I will say, though, that the participants heavily on the survey were district residents, which only has 66 of the 50 WMATA parking facilities, right? So, however, 44% participation of the district residents does sync up with sort of the customer base that we have. So just keep that in mind, but overwhelmingly definitely charge higher parking fees is what we heard. Metro access, their support in the general customer base about staying on track. 42% said you should charge more, $7.40. 40% said leave it alone, but 82% are saying leave it alone or charge more, but don't go back and to the fare structure or the proposal that was put forth before. And we did ask on the survey, and we did present the proposal that was out there about charging the lowest available fare. The 84% there refers to equity in pricing. We asked a series of questions about the differential between peak and off-peak. And customers, my take on this is that they want some rationality. So there should be some way to describe it's either
25% discount off the peak fare, or it is 10% discount off the peak fare. But having the range the way it is now and not having kind of a rule or a standard behind it is not favored. So we saw that there was 84% that want some consistency, either 10% off the peak or 25% as the general manager's proposal put forth. Next slide. Also a lot of discussion on passes. And when you look at these results, I just want to remind you that the very simple question that we asked was, would you favor any of the following? And customers could say yes to two, yes to four, or none. So they were not limited by being able to say, you know, which are the favorites. They just could say, would you favor one of them? Again, from the past research that we've previously done, I'm not surprised to see that 72% favor a one-day paper fare card or unlimited travel. Because a lot of times when we do research, we find that our customers are the biggest ambassadors for tourists and visitors. And they're always watching out for them. And sometimes when we're doing focus groups, we have to, well, that is part of it, but we have to remind them, speak for yourself, and we'll ask you about them later. But they're saying, oh, there should be a one-day fare card, unlimited, and it was explained in the survey that currently our one-day pass begins at 9:30 in the morning. So, and they also had all the costs associated with these on the survey. 52% like the 28-day pass and the smart trip. Seven-day pass on smart trip, 51%, a little fewer on the seven-day, and 28-day short trip paper card, not quite as popular. We also did describe our customized pass option, and only 45% were interested, or so 55 said that they did not have an interest in it. So it was not quite as high as some of these other options is what I would like you to know. Next slide. So as I mentioned, we also took the time to get into some policy questions. And to the point of Metro tightening up and looking for other options, we offered a question or asked customers to rank. So if separating basic bus, Metro Access, and rail service, If there are other support services that we offer that are basically to support the transportation services that we offer. So if you could you rank them in terms of importance? And the number one priority was to maintain our long-term planning functions, which I think was a surprise, but not with all the discussion that has gone on with the governance, not with the discussion about the rebuilding that's underway. And I think that the message that the customers are saying in all of this, don't go back to where we were. There are other findings here that would say that. Keep moving forward and don't lose sight of the future. Number two is onboard training and bus cleaning on board and the station manager's presence, which are all related to the basic hardcore transportation services that we offer. Number four was transit police officers, the presence of the officers, which I think speaks to, you know, get me to where I need to get to first. I do feel somewhat of a secure when I'm traveling with you, and these other issues are more important. And I think it would have risen higher if there were other major issues out there. Certainly, there are spot issues that the police chief can speak to. Station cleanliness, it is important, but not in terms of the actual trip delivery. I guess if you need to cut back, don't clean the outsides of the trains as much or the buses, and cut down on your telephone call center time is what we heard. Next slide. So This budget that's before you has a number of enhancements in it, and we also wanted to get a sense of how those enhancements, the priorities that customers have on those enhancements. The number one concern and issue continues to be safety, and we heard from them that we need to continue our work and focus on the NTSB requirements and compliance with that. Again, focus on the train service delivery itself and bus service delivery, the bus improvement enhancement package, that's what the number two one was. They ranked that number two. Rail car maintenance, again, back to actual transportation service delivery, the trip delivery. Elevator and escalator, that's the preventive maintenance item at rank four. Rush Plus, expansion of the rail rush hour service, is number five. The safety, I would not say that this is an indication that they don't value it as much as maybe they don't quite understand the context of it, I think, probably. But safety remains, I believe, by getting the NTSB rank number one is the highest priority. Adding the police, add more police is seven. Get ready for Silver Line. And then, as you'll recall, there was previously federal funding in the budget, and now in the new in the proposed budget, we are taking over the tourism prevention team, the funding of that, and that's what that is. Personnel expenses, we did ask a question about the pensions, and overwhelmingly they said that employees should contribute some to the pension, cost of the pension. Next question, next slide, rather. Discussion about funding. There were a couple of questions on that, but first, the survey, I don't have a slide here, but continued to say that you might recall that we asked for, you know, how do you see the jurisdiction's responsibility versus your responsibility as a rider, and they continued to say it should be shared, pretty much, is what we heard. But then went on to ask some questions about funding sources, and there's a lot of favorability about a dedicated revenue source of some sort. But also, I think the second one that was a little bit of a surprise is, 40% said, no, it's okay to go year to year and figure out what you need year to year. So, I'm not sure how to read that, but that was a surprise. And then the board has talked about an automatic annual adjustment against the consumer index, and that's what we were asking about there with the 27%. So next slide. So also we had the capital input at the same time because we put forth the capital plan, and so we just wanted to check on our order of priorities internally on how we rank and how we have our capital budget program. And RailTrack continues, they rank that as the number one, which is syncs up with everything else. It's all about the trip, the reliability of the trip, rehabilitation of the rail infrastructure, bridges, the platforms, et cetera, is number two. Number three, bus vehicles, rail car vehicles, parts, maintaining them. There was a series about we're spending money on equipment to maintain all of this. They're in sync with that. So one, two, three, and four speak to the quality and the reliability of the actual trip that we offer and the service that we offer. And so then the next tier I view is sort of the information flow, how I get my information. But critically is get me from A to B first, and then the customer facilities, which are the stations, the bus stops, et cetera, and then our own facilities, would be last. Capital priorities. So the question was, at some point in the future, if funding were to become available, please rank your order of preference of what you would like to see. Eight car trains comes to the top of the list. Addressing the station overcrowding to rehabilitate more lines, continue the work on the reliability. The next two were actually a tie, extend rail lines to serve future areas, address overcrowding of the bus routes, And also, I think this gets to adding entrances to the stations, kind of the overcrowding issue, and add express bus routes. Then the last three there were about the, you know, the carry-on of a virtual tunnel or an actual tunnel between Gallery Place and Metro Center, the next bus displays, and we asked some questions about the bicycle community, too. So, next slide. So, we also wanted to get a sense of the about our rebuilding efforts and our communication efforts related to rebuilding. And overwhelmingly, people know about that we're rebuilding. They've heard about the rebuilding program. They've seen it. And we asked a question, particular question, that if Metro should continue on this aggressive building schedule involving the weekend disruptions, or should we roll back, knowing, and we felt compelled to say, knowing that the risk could be reliability problems or service disruptions otherwise. And the message that we received back is full steam ahead, really. And we also asked about Metro Forward because we wanted to make sure we're reaching people. And 55% recall is a very, very impressive for a one-year campaign, really impressive. And we found that in-system communication continues to be the most effective way that we have to reach customers. The station posters, all the tactics that we've been using, posters, individuals in the stations handing out materials, banners, flyers, all those are really the most effective tool that we have. And more than three-quarters of the people that responded to the communications question said that that's how they knew about it. Listen. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Richardson, for that very interesting presentation, and I was kind of surprised about the long-range planning answer, but I won't tell you how many times I answered that question. Anyway, if there are any questions for Ms. Richardson, Mr. Dyke.
Yeah, back on page 38 when you talked about source of funding, the 69% who wanted a dedicated revenue source, were there any examples? I know in the business community we've talked about the regional sales tax and others, and I'm just curious, did they specify other sources, or they just said you needed to have a dedicated source?
No, we did not provide options. They didn't specify, but what I could do is dig into the other and see what we what comes up, and I can get back to you.
That'd be very interesting, yes. In that, because I think at some point we have to step up on that, and so let's see what people think.
Okay.
Mr. Nichols and Mr. Giancova, and then Ms. Hines.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you very much for the presentation. A lot of data, a lot of good data there to consider. And one of the things that I'd like to hear you talk a little bit more about is that 90% of the survey data came from the online survey. And I am a bit concerned about the context of the feedback relative to who makes up the online survey respondent versus who the rest of our customers are. And can you talk a bit about how reflective you believe that 90% is of the 100% of the folks who make up our ridership, both rail and bus? And I think that the double-edged sword for me, and I know that I'm sure you factored this in, is the opportunity to gather information in this environment, in our technology-driven environment, which is imperative that we take advantage of that. Our customers expect it, and we need to do it to run the system more efficiently. On the other hand, I wonder how many of our customers are in a position to take advantage of those tools, and I'm thinking, is it maybe just old-fashioned shoe leather might be a better way or an additional way, and you may be already doing this, to capture the sentiments. For example, we position people at bus stops where they wait for, you know, where they're waiting there for 15 minutes for a bus, and we're taking, obviously you can't do this extensive of a survey, but if key data you could gather with some of those customers that we generally have a sense are not getting to us. I think the people who come to the hearings really deserve gold stars, because to carve out time to get to our hearings and our forums is an extraordinary commitment on the part of our ridership, and we value that. On the other hand, most of our folks can't make the time to do that. And so how do we account for the views and the feelings of those people who aren't represented by any of the data here, or do you believe that they are represented by the data?
Well, first of all, the survey is one tool, and it's one tool in many ways that we get comments. And you're right, what we really try to do is try to reach the greatest number of people and try to invite as much comment as we can, also within the time constraint that we have, too. And we really do need to use online to quickly get out there. And we also have the hearings. We invite comments, and we invite letters, and so on and so forth. The way where the people are coming from the survey does sync up close to what we know about where people in general are coming from for ridership. But I will say, up until about a year ago, we were not aggressive about asking demographic information from people. And that is really important for Title VI requirements. And we allow people and we encourage people to fill out the demographic information. So I can't tell you exactly how it syncs up or doesn't sync up, except that from information I have from 08 and 07, the combined bus and rail for D.C. would be, you know, approximately 44-45% ridership. So, but going forward, we'll have a better idea. We'll get better demographic information. We could, going forward, having said all of that, we could do what you're suggesting is actually station people, and we have done, we have put people in the train stations. It's called intercept interviews. We can do that going forward in the future and ask questions, and you're absolutely right. We would be able to ask maybe 5 or 6, 7 questions in that format. The online survey does, I believe, serves a good purpose in that it's a gauge. It's one of several gauges that we have and several ways that we have to look at how people think about it. But also, I see it as an opportunity to ask a little bit more in-depth policy questions, which is what and how we used it, the ranking of the different things and the choices that you have before you, the ranking of the decisions in terms of investments that we do, an opportunity to ask about are we getting through. But that's, yes, we can always do more. In the future, in the next round, we could try to do intercept interviews as well. So that's sort of my point of view of it. But my point of view really, bottom line, is it's one of a number of ways. It is not the definitive measure.
Well, I think that's important, and I appreciate the enhanced discussion point. My concern is that it is just that. It's one slice of data. Important, but it represents probably maybe, I don't know, I shouldn't even say probably, because I really don't know, a narrow band of people that have the flexibility and the ability to engage in online surveys, and I'm not diminishing the value of it by any stretch, but I don't want to be in a position where I think it overly influences how we feel about the situation, because there are a lot of views out there, and I don't know that if we captured a qualitative survey of that represented our core bus ridership, would we get the same responses, and would we say, quote, most of the people feel this way or most feel that way? And I just hesitate to make judgments in terms of how most people feel on a survey as being reflective of how most of our riders feel. And it doesn't diminish the quality of the data, but I do want to put some context around it for what we have to do from a decisioning standpoint.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And my objective has been to try to do more and more and more and more and get more and more and more comments, and that is what's reflected here. And we can do even more in the next round and learn from that, and we have more tools coming up that we are going to do. I know you said you didn't want to diminish it, but it's significant to me that 3,600 people took the time to complete the survey. That is four times more than we've previously seen. So, but again, it's one of several, and it takes a lot of effort to show up at a hearing to make the time. So maybe, you know, the weight of that might seem a little bit more, but you're right. It's one of a number of ways.
Mr. Giancola?
Thank you for the report. I'm not sure I totally agree with Mr. Nichols' comments, but I do agree that our surveys are rail-centric. You know, there are more rail users seem to comment on it rather than bus users, so we may need to address the bus side, as has already been discussed. On page 36 or 35, you talk about budget priorities, support services, and really, if you look at those, three of them deal with train cleaning, bus cleanliness, all related to maintenance of the facility. And I'm reminded of Billy Crystal's invitation of Fernando Lamas in the 60s and 70s about it's not how good you feel, it's how good you look. And so I'm thinking that, you know, we've got to keep focusing on how good we look. And so I would encourage that. But it seems to me that it comes out loud and clear. The next page deals with escalator maintenance as a fourth priority or rank, and that surprises me, because when I get feedback from riders, and I do get feedback from riders, invariably the first thing on their list is escalators, and not so much elevators anymore, but certainly escalators. So I'm a little surprised that that did not jump to the top, and obviously that would be not my number one, but I didn't vote like Marcel did on the long-range planning, so that's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Hines?
Thank you. I actually have two sets of questions. You spent a lot of time, Barbara, walking us through the various outreach activities that you did and the number of languages and that sort of thing. My question to you is really, did you see input from a broader set of people on some of those characteristics, whether language minority or communities that you haven't typically heard from in the past?
I can't comment on that. Besides, I'd have to go back and okay. Really kind of look, slice and dice it. Yeah.
Well, that's an area that I think it would.
Metro, the whole metro access question, I think, is in the comments that we saw there. Probably it would be where I would look too for that.
Well, but I would point out, you know, we have people from 120 different countries living in Arlington, speaking 97 languages. Our second biggest language group is Mongolian. They live in Roslyn. They are transit users. Just as a curiosity, from my point of view, are we penetrating those kinds of communities? Because I think it's important. They add to the complexity of this region, but also they're big contributors to our economic vibrancy. So just want to make sure we don't lose sight of that as we look forward. The other question that I have relates to Jim's a little bit, where he asked about, you know, people sort of saying, how do we pay for this? Can you slice and dice the survey results based on where people live? Do you have that ability?
Yes, I can.
Okay, so I would really be very interested in seeing some of these same things, but arrayed by Maryland, Virginia, and the district, to see where we have common themes and
sure.
Where we're different.
By three.
Not by Arlington versus Alexandria, but
yes.
But sort of the Maryland, Virginia, and the district, I think, would perhaps provide us with some interesting suggestions about where opportunities to build are, particularly on this funding question.
Okay.
I think it would be important to understand. And then the last thing I wanted to wonder about, I guess actually there's two. Looking at this list of budget priorities for improvements, I think one of the issues we're going to confront as we work our way through to the end of this budget is what are we going to tell people about what's actually happening in this budget, and how can we tell them that in a fairly succinct way about things that they actually care about. And this list, in fact, provides us with some guidance about what perhaps the major points are that we need to respond back to people about, and thinking through how you do that somewhat graphically. You know, you told us, and you know, and all the caveats of where this data came from and all of that still indicates a lot of people are concerned about these things. So it's an opportunity for us to tell the story of where we've been for the last year and how we're continuing to make progress on that story, and what our commitment is in this budget to moving those marks in particular. And then the last observation I would have is the slide that sort of started with the 8-car trains and then moved down. A lot of that, even the 8-car trains, is about overcrowding. And so I think we ought to focus our attention a little bit on what strategies do we have in mind in the next 12 months to deal with some of this overcrowding, which is becoming a greater and greater issue, I think, for people on bus, as we talked about earlier, with rising bus ridership. I'm assuming we have more and more people standing on bus. I certainly, every time I get on during the rush hours in Clarendon, I never get a seat again. So, you know, I think we need to have some strategies here that we're trying to deal with that particular issue.
Okay, thank you for that comment. That, perhaps that's something we could take up in the Customer Service Committee at some point. I believe it was Mr. Bulger and then Ms. Porter. Okay, great. Ms. Porter?
First of all, I want to say that I think doing an online survey is an excellent way to get information, and I commend you for doing that. But I also wanted to second Mr. Nichols' concerns. Any online survey is going to be somewhat an opportunistic survey, and I very much appreciate all the work that you put into trying to get a good sample of people to do it. But any online survey, and this is not a criticism of this one, any online survey is going to pull a particular kind of person. And, for example, looking at the demographics of the survey, I noticed that 41% of the people who responded had a postgraduate or professional degree. That certainly doesn't represent probably our region. I don't know what our ridership looks like, but, I mean, it's a pretty high number.
But that's true, but our region is really is a very highly educated region, so I'm not sure how that would sync up, but you're right.
And I'm not, as I said, I'm not criticizing the survey. I'm just reinforcing Mr. Nichols' point that for people who don't have access to the internet, for example, you have to get them other ways. And I think his idea of going to some of the busier bus stops and actually handing out paper surveys would be a good way to get that. And so not criticizing the survey, but just making some suggestions for broadening the reach in a further effort that we might make at some point.
Thank you, Ms. Porter. Are there any other questions regarding the survey? Ms. Hutchins and then Ms. Bowser.
I am looking at the data in the back and thinking about other ways. Have we thought about the providers that we work with in the transit community in reaching customers? Because we do have providers that work with a demographic of customers, and it may be a tool to use to reach those customers. We take advantage, for example, of our access as well as our rider space as a voice, and can we expand those voices into the community to get more information? Otherwise, we are going to – I think my view of the online survey is if you look at the digital divide, we know where those who have access live and where they their participation, and so you're always going to lean on that. The question is, how do we mitigate that? And I think we can mitigate by reaching beyond just our customer as a customer, but how better to target that customer.
Just a question, maybe you can ask us how you ask this. This question on this peak of the peak, the kind of results aren't overwhelming, to the answer to that question about how we should move forward with peak of the peak. And I'm wondering if that just may be some confusion from the respondents as to what it really means, or if maybe this is, we're trying to solve a problem that a good number of people don't think is a problem.
Well, the questions and the way that we ask them are in the attached report, but I can certainly, I can read it out to you. It says, that right, it was in the writer's fare section, and it explained initially that the fare proposal is to generate $66 million. And then it said, at the same time and in response to customer complaints, the general manager, is proposing changes to simplify the fare structure, including eliminating the peak of the peak fare. Knowing that the peak of the peak fare generates $16 million, that's at the time we thought it was about 16 a year for Metro. Do you favor or oppose eliminating peak of the peak surcharge, the peak of the peak surcharge? Yes, eliminate peak of the peak, 57%. No, keep it, 43%. If no to the previous question, or if you answered no, you indicated that you would like Metro to keep the peak of the peak surcharge. Do you believe the surcharge should be increased or stay the same? Increase it, receive 20%. Keep it where it is, receive 80%. That's
all right. It just leaves me with the feeling that people don't want to see their fares increase, and so that these questions just basically say that, I don't want to see my fares increase. And they tell me little about this peak of the peak, and if the peak of the peak should be eliminated.
Yeah, so that's true. I think generally most of the comments and most people that were motivated to make comments don't want fares to go up.
So the first question says, yes, eliminate the peak of the peak, and if I'm the respondent, I'm saying because that will reduce my fares. And then the next question is about should the peak of the peak – I just think – I don't know that we're getting the information that says, listen, we got to go out and create a $16 million hole in our budget.
Yeah, so we did – we deliberately did put the dollar value in there. We felt – that we should ask the question. It's a major part of the proposal. And also, in past research, again, this gets to the online is one of many number of inputs. Past research, customers have indicated frustration about peak of the peak. And so it's sort of carry on that and, you know, wanting simplification of fare structure. So,
Ms. Hutchins.
I think in taking page 69 and 73 together, the question when you ask about peak of the peak, my first thought was, well, who's responding to peak of the peak? If we've just said we've left out a lion's share of folks who have an opportunity to opine, we are going to be missing a critical piece of data. But I think it's more comforting that we parse this question down to a point to at least be able to see that people understand, maybe, what it means. And I think that the interpolation of what peak of the peak means to some riders is very important here as well, if you put the demographic piece together. If we understand peak of the peak as not only moving people through the system, it's shifting the move based on cost, then if we understand that, we say, who does that affect? Mm-hmm. But if you ask who took the survey, it's even surprising that it wasn't even higher, because it might not matter to some people. that took the survey, when I think the numbers of by income is over 50 to 75,000, almost 50% of the surveyors are in that category.
Correct. Yeah, that's true. It may not matter to them.
Any other questions for Ms. Richardson? Mr. Downey.
A further clarification on the peak of the peak. Looking at page 69, the actual representation of the survey results, the first question said, do you favor or oppose eliminating? Answer, yes, eliminate. Second question says, if yes.
That should have been corrected. It should have said, if no.
If no, okay.
Correct.
Yeah. It's page 69 at the bottom. Yes. It's just,
it was asked properly.
It was asked properly. Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions for Ms. Richardson? Again, this is this is to be used as context for our decision making. It's not a perfect survey by any means, but I think it gives you a sense of what the ridership or those who've selected to respond have stated their in terms of their opinions. So I do think, again, everything that we hear from our public hearings to written testimony to the survey results to discussions that you might have with your own constituents all play an important role in our deliberations. So, again, we need to put this into some sort of context. With that, I'd like to move on. I believe Mr. Green will finish up.
Thank you. I'm now on page 43 of your packet. I'd just like to remind you of the FAIR policy principles. The general manager's initial FAIR proposal was developed with these principles and grounded with these principles in mind. The next few slides are going to try to capture that public sentiment that we received and also to capture some of the input we've received from the board over the last couple of months. So, based on public input and feedback from the board and previous discussions, these next few slides will reflect those areas with significant public or board interest and with some suggested modifications to the GM's proposal. Barbara mentioned in her presentation the public sentiment was particularly supportive of higher costs for paper fares, 79% supported. The board has also indicated in a couple of meetings a preference for a flat surcharge over the other two proposed options. One was the $4 and $6 fare. The other was a zone-based paper fare. So what we're highlighting here is the replacing the $4 or $6 option, which was the GM's proposal, with a surcharge on $1 paper fare. Off-peak adjustments. I think the general manager's been before you several times to introduce the concept of trying to more closely align the peak and off-peak fares, and as also mentioned on several occasions that it's probably going to take us multiple steps to get there. What we're proposing here is a slight modification to the original proposal to take out some of those anomalies that we had in the original proposal for several of the mileage steps. Also, there was a lot of sentiment on the rail passes, a lot of public support for the unrestricted, unlimited use of the one-day pass. It's a $14 pass. This mirrors the input we've received from the board over the last few months. And also there's a suggestion that the $28 rail pass for $230 available on Smart Trip, and we would maintain the seven-day short trip pass for $35 available on magnetic paper fare. On the bus side, there was a lot of public input and also board sentiment over the last few months related to the cash bus fares. Say that three times quickly. So you favor a lower increase for cash fares, and that's reflected here. Rather than a $2 flat fee for that bus service, we would recommend $1.80. Reducing cash on buses minimizes transaction time on bus loads and makes prices easier to understand and customer-friendly, and also not insignificantly reduces collection costs. On metro access, customers primarily had two concerns with the metro access fares. There was an economic impact and the predictability. We think by eliminating the proposal to go to the $7.40 max fare, that addresses the first. And also, there's going to be some benefit to these customers also with the slight reduction in the alignment of the off-peak fares. On the complexity of the paratransit fare structure, customers were concerned about fares changing without their knowledge. We have developed a web-based application that will allow Metro Access customers to determine their fares by time of day before making a reservation. We hope that this demo of the fare calculator will be given to the Accessibility Advisory Committee in May to ensure it meets the needs of our riders. So when combined, you can see that the elimination of the $4 and $6 paper fare card has a negative impact. The top part of the slide represents those adjustments that have a negative impact to the original fare proposal, which was a $66 million net increase, the CAS bus boarding, Metro Access max fare, et cetera, and the off-peak adjustment. And then the bottom left part of the display shows the increases with the other proposals in this recommendation. So given the changes outlined, the net is about a $10.5 million net change to the original $66 million proposal. So this is the slide that summarizes the presentation. If you start from the top, there was a $66 million original fare proposal. We just showed you on the previous slide that these adjustments based on public input and feedback we received from the board over the last few months have about a $10 million reduction in that impact. So the net of these fare increases of this revised proposal would be about $56 million. On the, if you take that then, if you'll recall, we had about a $103 million gap. We had reduced about $16 million from the original 119. We're down to 103. If you simply then take the $56 million in the fare proposal from that gap, then what you're left with is about a $47 million jurisdictional contribution, down from the original 53. Here is a summary of all the fare changes for consideration. When I quickly went through the previous couple of slides, I was just talking about those modifications to the original proposal. This is a summary of all of them. All the changes are also in your handout in the docket. Again, you can see the modifications here to Metro Access and other. Additionally, the analysis of this revised fare change proposal shows no disparate impact on the Title VI populations. One other item we'd like to bring your attention to is the importance of getting a timely direction from the board on the fare implementation so that we can do all the myriad of activities that need to occur between now and July 1st so we ensure a timely rollout of our fare change proposal. We'd also like to talk a little bit about the operating budget now. So it's just as a reminder, we're committed to continue the path of improvement that Metro has embarked on to improve safety, reliability, and enhance service for our customers. The budget requests to fund a base program of $1.6 million that funds bus, rail, and access operations and maintenance activities. We're continuing to improve our maintenance practice and reverse the years of underinvestment in the system. In addition to our focus on the NTSB safety projects, we are requesting funding to advance the management of worker fatigue, prepare for the Silver Line service, expand the rush bus service, and improve the capacity to perform maintenance equipment and increase elevator preventive maintenance. This slide is a summary. What it shows is the comparison between the 2012 and 2013 budget. It tries to capture on one sheet the impact of all of the changes that I've articulated over the course of this presentation, from the expenditure reductions, recognizing the action the board took last month on the Rush Plus with the advanced funding, and also on the revenue changes that we're proposing here. And what you can see is, again, as summarized, the revenue changes and the subsidy, net subsidy of $47 million. Here's a table of the jurisdictional contributions, and I'd just like to take a moment and thank the JCC. We've met with them twice over the course of the last 2 weeks, and I appreciate the time that they've invested and spent with us going over these recommendations, and also spent a lot of time on this discussion about the jurisdictional subsidies. So you can see, again, the $47 million increase, and we've broken it down by jurisdiction. And we've supplied you with some very detailed tables in the last couple of weeks that give you a little more detail on this high-level summary. So the recommendation is to approve the public hearing staff report on the public outreach held in February and March, approve the revised fare change proposal to be implemented in July, and to consider approval of the FY13 budget proposal. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Green. Before we begin our discussion, I'd like to perhaps make another set of suggestions in terms of how we organize our meeting of the last part of this meeting. I know that, again, there are a lot of comments and questions that you would like to put on the table, but I also think it's important that we organize this in a way that it's clear as we go through the proposed fare changes to keep track of where we're at, and also to hear, you know, any comments or questions you might have, say, for instance, on the passes versus the peak fares. So what I'd like to do is cover that first. Also, I know there may be some additional questions about the subsidies, operating expenses. I know Mr. Nichols raised the issue of out years and how the implication of, you know, everything that we're doing in terms of our out year budgets and kind of whether we're putting the cart before the horse. But we will get to all those questions hopefully during the course of this discussion. But I do think it's important to get a sense from the committee as to their reactions based on what you've heard from the public, given the changes in our fiscal situation, where we do have a little more latitude in terms of considering other fare options that are less drastic in terms of what we may be imposing to the public and our riders. And I do think it's important that we kind of walk through that chart and kind of get your reactions to that and answer any questions that you might have. So what I would suggest we do is if you go to page 48, and if we could put that up there, it is up there, the summary of fare changes for consideration. I would like to walk through this, and then we'll take them in probably groups. And at that point, we'll ask your questions or get your reactions. With respect to the proposed fare changes for consideration. And if there are any other issues, we'll talk about that at the end. This will also include a discussion about Title VI, as you'll see on the second page here. So if that's okay with the committee, this will just allow us to keep track of any comments that you have and whether we have consensus on any or all of these of these points. So what I suggest we do is start with the first two, which kind of go hand in hand under Metrorail, which is to eliminate the peak of the peak surcharge and instead increase peak period rail fares by 5.7%, increase max fares to $5.75. So with that, I'll open it up for discussion. So again, this is the notion of eliminating the peak of the peak surcharge and replacing it with a different peak period fare. Any questions, discussions, comments regarding that?
Mr. Acosta.
Yes, Ms. Bowser.
Can we just clarify once again? So if the peak of the peak was maintained, what were the alternative increases explored otherwise? So I'm sorry, that didn't make sense. So we have a 5.75 increase in rail. Is that correct? Okay. On average, with the elimination of the peak of the peak.
In the peak period, not the peak of the peak, but the peak period, the average increase would be just a hair under 5% for folks, depending on whether they were, and it varies, depending on whether they were affected by the peak of the peak or not.
So if the peak of the peak was maintained, you would still want to maintain that 5.75% increase, and that's why that's the difference in the $12 million?
If the peak of the peak were eliminated, then the folks in the peak period would be paying about a 7.8% increase in their fares.
You mean if it was maintained, if the peak of the peak was maintained?
Yes, if it was maintained, yes, sorry about that.
Okay, so if the peak of the peak was maintained, everybody would pay 7% more?
7.8, I think it was. 7.8%.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other questions regarding or comments regarding the peak of the peak? Ms. Cowan, and then we'll go to Mr. Dyke.
Just a question. What's the difference in the revenue from the scenario that Ms. Bowser's just asked about?
If you did not eliminate the peak of the peak.
Right, versus if we do.
It's about $10 million, right? Yeah. About $10 million, I think it was.
I'm sorry.
$10 million, about.
Mr. Dyke, and then Ms. Hines.
Yeah, well, that was sort of getting at what I was concerned about, is if we kept peak of the peak, how would that impact overall the increase that customers would see? Because just from a practical point of view, I'm a little reluctant to give up that kind of revenue at a time when we know we have holes in the budget. We're going to have bigger deficits year as we go into the next fiscal year and the year after that. And the question is, if we take it out now, does that mean we're going to have to, in essence, ask even more going forward? So that's why I'd like to know, have some information now, if we decided to keep that, how would that impact, at least overall, what the customer experience under this proposal?
And the other part, and let me just go back to the original reason for proposing elimination of the peak of the peak. Well, a couple of things. One was when the peak of the peak was put in, which was the last fare increase, it was for two reasons. One was to raise revenue, obviously. And the other was to, from a policy point of view, to promote a shift for people to move out of the peak of the peak to the shoulders of the peak. And as we've discussed before, that did not happen. But the other reason for this was the complexity of our fare structure. And the commentary we've received about how complex our fare structure is, it's hard to understand. And when we put in the peak of the peak, we added considerably to that complexity. So when you go up to that vending machine, before you had two columns to look at to figure out what your fare was, now you're into three columns to look at, and you just watch people. And I think Dr. Gridlock captured it best in his January column. People just stare at it and try to figure out what's going on here and how do I get from here to there, especially people that are new to the system. So that was one of the driving things as we were looking at fare adjustments was to – this was an opportunity for the board to consider simplifying the system, going back a step, if you were. And, frankly, that's, you know, as we heard in the public hearings, Metro Access folks in particular – it's very complex fare structure for them to understand. It's complex for every other passenger to understand, and that was those two items were the driving forces to propose elimination of peak of peak.
I'd like to add one other item on that because, as you know, we're looking to replace our fare payment system to accommodate for the technology that our riders, a lot of them, use today, and that complicated system created, I think it was 45,000 combinations in terms of fare tables. And to simplify it is much better and would be less complicated to introduce a new fare payment system as we go forward. I understand the concern about revenue in the future, but, you know, when you're looking at the investments you have to make in the future to replace your legacy system, that was also a consideration.
Well, it's I understand that, and I think we need to discuss it a little more. And quite honestly, some of us who have some very specific and clear ideas about making the fare system simpler, I won't go into that right now. I think that's more a long-term discussion. But I'm just, from a revenue perspective, I'm just a little bit not quite ready to take that kind of money off the table at this point. But obviously, we're going to have a discussion to go back and forth, and I realize there's some other implications of that. So I need to noodle on it a little bit.
Okay. Ms. Hines, and then Mr. Downs, and then Ms. Hudgens.
So I want to – I'm looking at page 74 of 80 of the attachment, and just kind of reminding ourselves of the various things that we did advertise, because those are – in fact, choices. We advertised a maximum peak fare of $5.75 and of $6. And so I'd appreciate being reminded both of the impact if we went to $6 in terms of the revenue it would generate, but also what that means in terms of growth for the rider fare and how that comports with our policy. If you could remind us of that, that would be great.
Bill, do you have the numbers on that? Okay.
Sure.
The 50 cents would cost, oh, excuse me, that was a surcharge reduction. I apologize. Let me get another section.
Yep. It's, I'm just looking at the max fare.
We'll get it.
Perhaps
we'll
you can get back to us.
Yeah.
That would be.
We'll come back to it. Sure.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Mr. Downs.
No.
I'll let them continue to look. I don't know about the rest of the board. I got a headache trying to figure out impacts on various classes of riders in jurisdictions, aligning off-peak fares with peak fares, base fare, $1.70 max fare, $3.70, eliminate peak of the peak surcharge, base fare set at $1.70, non-smart trip surcharge of $1, one-day passes, $14, valid all day. I'm like the general manager. I watched a family recently trying to figure out how to buy a fare card. And I finally went over and asked them if I could help them. And they said, what's it cost to get from here to the zoo? Well, I said, it depends on the time of day and other things. And I said, why don't you just buy, put 10 bucks in for every, you know, everybody who's riding, and when you get back out, go to add fare if you need to add more money. That felt like a really stupid set of recommendations. This reminds me of the U.S. tax code. We're making sets of decisions about how much revenue we need when the objective ought to be that the fare structure is simple and predictable. If we keep making fare changes like this every time we come through a budget process, we're making this much more complex for our customers than we actually need to be doing. Pretty soon we'll have to have concierges to get people through the fare collection system because it's too complex to either explain or post on a board. I think it's a mistake to think of the peak, for instance, as simply a revenue source. It does have a cost in the system about the complexities in the system. It was actually, I think, primarily a revenue item. It was, we put it in to plug a hole in the revenue side. It didn't actually impact any peak of the peak ridership. If we keep it, we're just saying we're making it complex because we need the money. If we need the money, we ought to raise the overall set of fares in a way that is predictable and usable for the customer. I don't know what to do with this except to recognize that we're in a trap of making it more complex to capture more revenue when we ought to be thinking about how we make this as simple and as predictable going forward as we possibly can. I don't have an answer except a policy framework in the future that is beyond what we talked about with the 10 points that we adopted in 10 that says our main objective is adequate revenue with a fair system that is simple and predictable over time for our customers. We have to do better than this, and I hope the technology allows us to do part of this. But I'll be frank with you, I can't figure out what disparate impact there is here by types of bus riders, by jurisdiction, by rail riders, by time of day, it's incomprehensible, and there's no real data that gives us that sense about where we're going with this.
I will only add on to Mr. Downs in the sense that I think Peak of the Peak was brought in as a pricing element. And we have customers that do not check out because of price, because they can't afford to check out. And I think that's one of the challenges we have. We are concerned about our customers, and we're concerned about our revenue, but we have to make a choice and say how we're going to balance those concerns. And for people who our data doesn't tell us the demographics of who truly use our systems where in a very clear way. And I will use my anecdote as Mr. Downs, is that I ride the system from some of the farthest ends, and it's bus and rail. And for some, it's bus, rail, and bus. And so the implication to me of the data about Peak of the Peak and looking at the economics, the income levels, the choices that people are making in terms of saying Peak of the Peak is fine might be those that say it is fine because from an economic standpoint, it doesn't impact me when I ride, how I ride, how I get there. I buy a smart trip card, I tap it, and I keep going. But for some people, they have to think about it. And so when you start before the Orange Line starts coming into the district to work or to go the opposite from the Green Line to go into Virginia to work, you have to think about that customer across all of those demographic lines. I heard from AAC as well as Rider Advisory, simplicity and cost are important to them. So I think we need to think about how do we respond to our customers in regard to that. We know we need to share the cost, and the cost sharing has to be balanced if we want to continue to serve those well. I'd ask the question about, to Mr. Downs and I think Mr. Dykes, to questions about when and what in terms of our fair infrastructure we would change and the fair media we would change so that we get a sense of if we make this choice today of eliminating it, what's our opportunity to better serve the customer as well as deal with this revenue piece in the future?
Well, just simplifying the fair tables, so the tables that a rider will look at, primarily people who look at those fare tables above the ticket vending machines are probably tourists or infrequent riders, and they will have a better understanding as to, you know, what it is. And it's just the 45,000 combinations will actually go away from our fare table. So the infrastructure of calculating, the calculating engine that is used as you tap into a gate and you tap out of a gate, is much simplified because those calculations are not happening. And I think it's more important not with the existing infrastructure as much as very, very important for the future infrastructure that we are moving towards for our customers to have ease of payment. And so simplifying the fare structure by using and having the capability of using whether it's a smartphone or an app or whatever you have in your pocket to pay that fare is very critical. And the infrastructure piece is kind of contingent on having some type of simplification of what that fare calculation engine does. And so looking to the future for that is where the simplification comes in.
And I guess I did say a win, and I know it's not a definite number, but I think...
Well, I could give you a time frame that, you know, we are in the critical stages of the RFP for this and intend to award sometime this summer to have a proof of concept of this capability by next year. So it's really right around the corner in terms of that type of infrastructure and capability.
Mr. Nichols and Mr. Dyke.
Get the right button. Thank you. As I often do, I am going to align myself with all of the comments that were just brought up, and I'll do that in this context. I appreciate the spirit of Mr. Dyke's comments, that we are in a position where we are making revenue decisions that when we are considering eliminating revenue sources, when we know that we don't have enough revenue. And so that is, I clearly can align myself in the spirit of that question, because in a year or so we'll be figuring out how we're going to raise more revenue. At the same time, I strongly believe that it is important that all of our decisions are made with the strongest policy reasoning behind them. And I think that we need to drive toward that. As Mr. Downs has said, we're in a very frustrating situation right now, because as much as we believe we're moving toward more simplification, it's still way too complex, even with the steps that we are making. And hopefully with the changes in technology and our improvement in our systems, it will, at some day, we'll see a clear sky. We have to have faith that we're getting there. And we do believe we do. But one of the, but there are two pieces that I think are missing for me. One is, I think our highest and best calling as a board is to press for as much data, accurate data as we can. And I don't think that we know enough about our customers yet. We've got to continuously drive to understand who our customers are and what they really do feel. It's one of the reasons I was bothered by, not by the work that our staff put in terms of preparing the surveys, but we can't disproportionately rely on data that is not reflective of our real riders in total. And I think we've got to make it a priority to seek that data just as much as we seek the data of those customers that can more conveniently respond to our surveys. It's not a criticism of our work, but it's saying that we've got to increase our investment in gathering data that tells us how our customers really do feel and who they really are. That's important from our decisioning standpoint. Second thing is, it's troublesome for me to look at fare considerations in the absence of knowing, of having a clarity of the implications of those decisions today on 14 and 15. That is a gap for me, and I know we're going to talk about it a little bit later, but it's challenging for me to segment the discussion around fares without discussing expense and expense associated with the implications of the decisions that we make. I am supportive of what we've proposed, but I also am left very wanting of what the implications of this set of decisions is for what we have to do next year and the next year. And that is an absent piece of data for me as I look at this particular piece of information.
Mr. Dyke.
I think I've stated where I am on peak of peak and my concern, but Tom has kind of opened the door, and I'm sort of sitting here looking at the elephant in the room here, and being the newest member of the board, I figure I have obviously less experience in what you've discussed in the past and what the history is, and I think I have some idea. But from a long-term perspective, and I'm not asking us to look at this now, but I think we have a responsibility as a board to at least discuss and talk about the implications of having a flat fare system here, which is used in other jurisdictions. And I realize we get into questions of fairness, and I realize some people who have short trips will have certain views on that, and others who have a longer trip have different views. But if we're exploring a lot of options and we realize we may have some budget issues coming up in the future and we're concerned about simplicity, that's as simple as it gets. And I think it would be appropriate for us to at least begin the discussion and gather the data and see whether or not that might be a feasible option in the future. It may well be that it's not, but I think I'd be irresponsible if I didn't sit here and ask, what does it look like and how would it work?
Okay, these are all very good comments. No, they are. But I also, even though I'm a long-range planner, I also have to be practical here. Now, we have a budget in front of us that we have to at least get through and adopt by June. That, you know, we have advertised the docket with certain fares listed that we are now in the process of reviewing, that we have to do this in a responsible way, that we basically establish a fare structure that we can build upon over the course of future fiscal years. And do it in a way that's sustainable. I think there are some major changes proposed in this fare structure that will lead us to simplification. And also, I do believe there'll be some questions about the passes, but I think how do we migrate people to passes in a, I think is a core question, then how do we build upon that? Because that's also a way of simplifying fares for a majority, for some of our customers. I would just say a majority of our customers, but perhaps for some of our customers. I also think with respect to the fundamental question that Mr. Dyke raised, both Mort and I worked in agencies that actually had flat fare systems. We're also looking at, why can't we do distance-based systems like they did at WMATA? So I do think there are trade-offs in terms of that, but I also think you have to consider the context of what our customers are accustomed to, and then whether you want to impose such a change on them that, you know, each agency, each property has its history, and it kind of has its culture, and to some extent from day one, at least on the rail side, the system was built on distance-based fares. And to change that, I think, is a very fundamental change. And if we're going to do it, we need to do it for the right reason, and that we have to look at it from all angles. We're not going to accomplish that today, and we're not going to accomplish that within this budget cycle, I can tell you that. But I do think that's an interesting question that you've raised, but I also think that will take a lot of public discussion, because I do think our customers will probably have a variety of reactions to that proposal. I think that's fair, and I think it's an important thing to put out there, but I don't necessarily know if we could accomplish that over this cycle. But I am attempting to do is just to get a read from our board members in terms of where, you know, given the fare structure as proposed and all the changes that were put on the table today, to get a read in terms of any issues that may still be out there and or discomfort about certain things. We did hear certain responses to Peak of the Peak, and that I don't necessarily know if they're if we could get past that, but I also think it was duly raised. Mr. Gowdy?
Yeah, if we're moving beyond Peak of the Peak, I'd like to speak a little bit about the surcharge on paper. I was concerned when we first talked about changing that, particularly as it impacts visitors, tourists. Pretty easy to see under some of these structures, a reasonable sized family laying out $100. For a day's use of the system. What I've seen now with the new proposal and with the analysis that you provided about options suggests to me there are ways that a user can find the best fare, but I'm with Mr. Downs, it's not going to be easy to do that. What trip are you going to take? What time is it? How many days are you going to be here? I would hope that we work hard to provide the information in a channel that people can use and say, what is the best package for me and how do I design that? But I said, I think we still will have a certain number of people who don't understand, who will just go for what they think is the simple, take the paper ticket, pay $100 and never come back again. So let's think about that. I think also the premise that adding to the cost of the paper ticket as an encouragement to go to the smart trip is the direction to go. It certainly is in line with the ultimate direction of going to a much more flexible fare system. I think we should be looking as well at how do we lower the cost of the smart trip in order to encourage that movement as well. And I would hope that that stays on the table.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Any other questions regarding or comments regarding the surcharge since we're on that topic right now? Ms. Hines?
Thank you, Mr. Costa. I appreciate that we're mostly worried about tourists relative to this, but there are another category of folks who do tend to buy paper fare cards for bus and other or for rail, and that's folks who don't have enough money to sort of load the smart trip card. So I guess when we first made this migration, there was a push out to social service agencies and other kinds of entities that had more likelihood of interacting with low-income customers to get the smart trip cards in their hands. And I think we probably need to redouble our efforts there. And we had talked last year at some point about whether or not there was a way to work with those agencies around ad fare at their agencies so that's a place we know people go, and they often ride the bus to get there. So can we redouble our efforts there as well? The last time I checked, and this may have changed, along our Columbia Pike corridor, which is a very heavily used corridor, many, many low-income folks, and the whole thing of loading on the bus is an issue. We have only one or two drugstores along that 5 or 6 mile strip that actually have an ad fare capacity at them. And that's just, it's insufficient for the number of people. So I think we need to work this question again in collaboration with our jurisdictions to try to find some additional solutions if we're going to go this way. Because my understanding is it's a dollar every time I use that card. It's not that it's an extra dollar I pay for the card. It's every ride I take has a dollar added to it. So it is a significant incentive, but for some people to figure out the alternative is, I'm sure, going to be difficult.
Mr. Downs and then Mr. Jankola. Okay.
Mr. Downs. One last item. The smart trip capacity to have a $5 deficit, I think we're the only transit system in North America that allows customers to run a card at a deficit. In effect, we advance people money and the system, and then we have to price that into the fare card price. It, in effect, becomes a barrier for smart trip penetration around the system. I think it was a dumb policy. I think it was well-intentioned. I think it is not ultimately where we want to go, and at some point in this process, whether or not it's part of what we do about fare changes or fare policy, we need to address that and eliminate the ability for somebody to run a $5 deficit on a card. If we're within a year here, we need to figure out now what we're going to do with that kind of hidden credit that we offer in the system.
Actually, we're partially addressing that. For magnetic, if you're a paper card holder, you have to have the minimum value to enter the system. We do not have that same rule for Smart Trip. And I think it was done in the past in order to get people to use Smart Trip. So this year we will be changing that. It'll be a minimum boarding charge that you will have to have on your Smart Trip card. And that'll partially address.
You still have the ability for
somebody to exit in a negative value, but they can only do that once. And so that is an issue. And as we come forward to the board and discuss our plan to lower the price of the Smart Trip card, that will be part of the plan in terms of how we change the exit and entry rules to accommodate for that. So.
Okay, any other questions? Mr. Giancola.
Yeah, I presume we're still on the number of first bullet here, right? I support that. It does simplify the system, which was the intent. So I seem like we're getting hung up on other issues and we haven't got to them yet, but I certainly support the simplification through the elimination of the peak to peak. I just wanted to go on record as saying that. We need to move on, folks. I'm not sure I want to go back to a discussion on the I know I don't want to go back on a discussion of a flat fare system at this point. Maybe in the future we can evaluate it, but not right now.
Mr. Bowser, do you have a question? Okay. Actually, we had moved on to, because Morda raised a question about the surcharge. Just before we move off the surcharge, I know this was a alternate to the $4 flat fares as well as the Zode fares. So this was a recommendation that came out of that process. Do people feel comfortable with that, or would they like to go back and talk about that? If not, we'll move on. Okay. Also, I just wanted to note there was an effort here to rationalize off-peak fares as well as the base fares at $1.70 and a max fare at $3.50. Are there any questions about that or comments? Okay, moving on, we'll take the last three in terms of the passes together, in terms of rail passes. Are there any questions or comments about the way the rail passes are proposed as of this time?
I had a question.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Dyke.
I asked it earlier, and so I think I know the answer, but I just want to get on the record, and that is, am I correct in that the 28-day pass does include a discount? Is that correct?
Yes, it does. It was priced based on someone using it 10 trips a week, so your commuter, and if you use, so it priced 10 trips a week times four weeks. As a result, weekends or any other additional trips would be free. So there's a discount associated with that.
Yeah, because I'd gotten several inquiries from folks who thought there was no discount, and I just wanted to make it clear that in fact was the case so that they would know that. Mm-hmm. Yep. And also, just for the record, I indicated that the discussion about flat fare was for the future. Clearly, we can't do it. But I also did not want to run away from the issue that needs to be discussed in the future. Clearly, we can't do it in this cycle. I understand that, and I'm prepared to support this if we have to go forward. But we have to talk about it going, at least I'd like information going forward. So I just want that to be clear.
Could I just ask for clarification about the ability to load the 28-day and the 7-day fast pass for transit benefits?
So the issue is, and I've had this question, why can't you use transit benefits on the pass products? And the issue we have is we have about, I think it's about 3,800 employers in the region, federal and non-federal, that provide smart benefits to their employees. And most of those employers take the unused benefit, the unused monthly benefit that they provide to those employees, they want that unused benefit rolled back to them. And if we put the smart benefits on a pass product, they would be unable to get that benefit back to them, the unused benefit that the rider does not use. And so as a result, we would not be compliant with not just the, I'm not interested in the IRS as much, but I am interested in the employers who are paying us the smart benefit cost. And as a result, that would be a hard thing to do.
Just like a question. I know that's the way my agency handles smart benefits because they sweep it, but would it be worthwhile to talk to the Office of Personnel Management or GSA or those that administer the smart benefits program to see if it is indeed practical to do that and kind of what are the policy implications, at least from the federal government side. I can't speak to the private employers who may do the same thing, but it does seem like it would limit our ability to promote passes if we weren't able to offer it to a larger audience. And I mark it, and I think if we decide to move in this direction, perhaps in a couple months, you could come back and report to us what that would take. And then also we would have to then discuss any changes or increases in cost to reprogram the smart trip.
We can do that. There is an IRS guideline that guides how the transit benefit should be used. So we have to be, not, we don't have to be cognizant of that as much as the user does, as well as the employer. So we would discuss that with them.
Under the IRS guidelines, it's my understanding that transit benefits can be used to buy a commuter monthly rail pass, which you then can use as much as you want on that commuter railroad, and IRS has not raised that issue. So I think there's precedent for what's being suggested here.
Mr. Costa.
Mr. Bolger?
I just want to confirm that that's true, Mort. And as far as employers retrieving unused employee benefits, that is only applicable to the government agencies that subsidize the benefit.
No, it's government and
I understand. Well, hold on. In first instance,
okay.
Carol, because the federal government is giving employees cash to mm-hmm. take the benefit,
that's
to
right.
get the benefit. Okay, so they could probably sweep it back. As far as the private employers who have set up what we call pre-tax, mm-hmm. okay, that's the employees' revenue.
That's correct.
All right, and cannot be swept back on a monthly basis, and that is completely, unrealistic. So let's separate the question. Subsidized transit benefit providers by the government is cash. Private employers, for the most part, do pre-tax. Mort's mm-hmm. hit the nail on the head. Passes are eligible. They're on a monthly basis. I think employers don't want to be doing it on a weekly basis. That's too much administrative requirements. It's a month to month, and it's in arrears. Mm-hmm. It's not like April 1st that you kick off April. That was done back in February for that employee because of the HR systems we have. So I just want to clarify that for the record.
Thank you. Ms. Hines.
Thank you. I have many of the same questions because I've been asking. But so as you're doing your work on this moving forward, one of the other things that might be useful to us is what are other agencies doing? Most other agencies have passes. Not only how do they do it, but what do they see in terms of use of them might also help us figure out mm-hmm. where we might fit into this market. So I would encourage us to do that. And I have a particular question on the 5750 fast pass. I keep having to look every time at which one am I talking about. The chart that you sent us, the really helpful chart that you sent us, people are currently paying $47 for that right now.
That's correct.
And it's on paper.
That's correct.
And we're moving it to Smart Trip, and that has always been planned. So it's taking almost a $10 jump in price, mm-hmm. so which has to be one of the bigger increases that we're looking at overall in this. Why is it moving up so much in the price?
Well, it's related to obviously the fare increase, proposed fare increase that we're having, and it also had related to the amount of trips that people were taking. And so we looked at that and tried to devise a price that was comparable to reflect that.
So what does this presume? I mean, $57.50 is 10 times the new max price.
Yeah, that's $5.75. That's fair, $5.75, and then assume 10 trips a week.
Right, but the 47 was not calculated based on the maximum.
No, I actually, when we looked at this, we realized the 47 was actually considerably lower based upon what we saw the trip use was. I mean, so we wanted to correct that. I mean, the trip use for that, I think, is an average about 14 trips a week. So the users that were paying $47 were getting a pretty good deal And so a good deal. And so they're still getting a good deal at 57, although it's markedly more, you're right. But it is still a better deal, and it is a does reflect a discount. I think we probably made an error in FY11 when we went to the increase in fares, the last fare increase, and did not look at that product. So.
Okay.
Might I just jump in? I just wanted to follow up on that point. I recognize that I'm out of order because I kept asking myself why these numbers weren't adding up to Mary's point. And that's why, to Jim's point, people are saying they're not getting a break with these passes because, in fact, they have gone up more than what's represented here because they were getting more of a discount.
They were.
And so that's troublesome. And more than that, I think people also expect that the 28-day pass, they would realize more of a benefit than if they just bought 4 7-day passes. So why is it that we can't discount this 28-day pass? That's one question. The other question is, why don't we just base, you know, if we were basing this last pass on 470, which was 30 cents less than the max fare, couldn't we do the same here and base this pass on, what did I just say, 30 cents less than the max fare with the new pass?
Well, I mean, the board can do anything.
Okay,
recommend.
Good. So let's
so
figure
I'm just,
out.
But yeah, let me just,
yeah, yeah, let me just, have we calculated that cost instead of 40, at 4?
If you,
it was at 470 and the max fare was $5, right?
So let me be a simple calculation that I have in my head because I can't do a million. But if we took the 28-day pass price, which is currently proposed at $230 a month, and it's based on maximum fare, $5.75, 10 trips a week, 4 times a month. And if we took that and discounted it to 10% to $208, I think that's right, we would probably lose anywhere from the fare box revenue would go down by anywhere to $4 to $5 million a year. And that's because people would, the existing riders that we have would move to a cheaper product. I would. So I would, the existing riders who are paying something now would move to a cheaper pass product. It would not necessarily, it could incent new riders, but I have no basis for making that assumption at all. It would be just a fly on the wall. I have no history of that. And
but
so
yeah,
that's
I understand,
what would happen.
But this is what I would rather that than just that you were also proposing the peak of the peak reduction that doesn't attract anybody new but just shifts things around. And I think I've heard more from people about the wanting a convenience of a pass. And by the way, I will get to the what this means for the short trip passes. But I think that we've heard even from your data more emphatically about people wanting a monthly pass where they actually save money.
Well, I would argue that the monthly pass, the way we priced it currently, the proposed price at $230 a month, implies a great discount. It's priced on maximum fare at 10 rides a week, which is a commuter, to and from work, 5 days a week. That means every other trip after that, on nights, side trips, shopping trips, weekend trips, they're all free.
But Ms. Kissel, what the people, you know, that we've heard from say that they're not getting a big discount because they were getting more of a discount with a $47 a week
correct.
Pass.
That's correct.
And, you know, frankly, that we haven't, nobody's has put that on the table before.
No, I understand that.
But, you know, and I just kept, and I'm glad Mary put it on the table because those numbers just weren't adding up. And so now you see a jump from 47 to 57.50. I don't even know what that works out to be. What is that, 20%?
I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah, and Shannon reminds me. And you're absolutely right. I'm not arguing that point at all. I can only say that in FY11, we never increased that pass product. And I think it just got lost, to be honest, because the amount of people that were buying that pass product and still currently buy that pass product is extremely small. It is actually probably 0.3%. It's a very small amount of riders who buy it. I think what I'm hearing from the board is that they want to look at pass products so we can increase the use of the pass products and people can utilize those in a more
better way. Well, I think what that suggests is it's not priced correctly. People would use it if it, you know, to trade giving you my money earlier means that I need to get something of value back.
Well, the number of people who were buying the pass, I was commenting on the pass that was priced at $47. There was not a lot of purchases of those passes. We had not a little use of those.
Thank you. Those
okay. Ms. Porter?
I'm very supportive of the passes, and I'm not at all surprised that people aren't buying a lot of the 28-day passes, because it's unless you pay maximum fare or close to maximum fare, there's absolutely no benefit in it for you at all. And if we price it at the point that it's being proposed, there is no benefit in it for anyone other than people who are at the absolute maximum, and for them there is no discount. There is the opportunity to ride more than their weekly commute for free, but there's no discount. And if somebody thinks, well, what's the chance, you know, maybe in the next month I'll get sick one day. And if you get sick one day, you've almost obviated the benefit of it. And so we're not pricing the passes in a method to be attractive to people at all. And my guess would be, just as Ms. Bowser said, that if we raise it up so that there's no discount at all for people in buying a 28-day pass, only the opportunity to ride additional trips for free, will get even fewer people. I don't think we will get large use of the pass products until we get to the point, and I understand we're not there at this point, that we can, that there's passes at different levels for people to ride different. I mean, we've got the short trip, but I mean, that's not going to take care of everyone. If we really want to get people to use passes, I think you've got to offer them some kind of a discount. Now, if we offered only a 5% discount off the pass, that's, you know, $11.50 off of $230, that might be enough to get people to do it. $11.50 would be what, 2 days worth of, or two trips worth, that might be enough to get people to do it and might overcome the concern that, you know, what if I don't go into work one day in the next 28?
Well, I agree totally to your statement. I think Mary Hines brought it up a while ago about, I call it the customized pass, and it's customized so that it's, you know, for short trips, for longer trips, for middle trips. Our system is not capable of doing that, and so And it would be great to do it, and we have it on our plan now because we heard a lot of information from it. It takes some programming changes. It'll take some time to change. It kind of is consistent with Mr. Dyke's comment on a flat fare. I mean, that's kind of where you're going with the pass. It's that same kind of concept in terms of technologically how to employ it. That's what I'm talking about, not in terms of the product, but how you technologically deploy that type of a concept. It's a very customized thing, very customized.
Mr.
I think Mr. Barnes had a question, then Ms. Hines.
On the on the maximum peak fare increase from $5 to $5.75, that's obviously a big percentage increase and a big hit for somebody that would use that. It's $7.50 a week. $30 a month, we're beginning to talk real money here, as they say. Can you discuss the rationale on that? Are we heavily subsidizing people that ride a long way?
Yeah, we do, and I will say that it's really in anticipation of the Silver Line. So as we extend the line out, the max fare, I think, last year or this year would kick in if you're a rider at, I want to say at 15 miles, or 14, thank you. And so what happens is that when we'll extend the Silver Line, that'll have some implications. And so we looked at that as we increased the max fare, because we will have to start to address that issue. And so as you lengthen the line, your max fare will kick in sooner for a rider. They'll hit that max fare sooner than later.
We all heard at our hearings from people who are struggling with the fares we have, and this is a big percentage increase.
Yeah.
But I understand the implications. Thank you.
Ms. Hines?
Mr. Costa, thanks to everybody for the conversation on passes, because I do think this is, in our future, this is an important piece. And I think that, I don't know where I am on whether we should do these or not. It's, you know, the seven-day pass really works mostly for the people at the ends of the line.
Yeah.
It really, for those of us whose riders are predominantly in the core, this is not a product that is at all of interest. It just doesn't cover what people are actually doing. You have to, so the question really, though, is as we move forward, as we think about this, whatever's going to come next, as Ms. Porter said, I think we have got to figure this out. It is linked to crowding, because as we make the system more affordable, we potentially push the ridership, and so we really have to get our arms around that piece as well. But I most other systems have a way for people who are regular riders to take advantage in the off times without having to pay the full freight. And I think for us to not get to something like that is a mistake as a long-term strategy for our region. So I guess it goes on this future list that we're compiling, and we'll have to sort of figure our way through whether these products are particularly advantageous or not at the moment. I have so appreciated everybody sort of digging in and understanding, and what we found is that there's more complexity, I think, to it than any of us really understood at the beginning. And we really do have to look at who does it encourage versus who does it just, it's neither here nor there because it's not economical.
Are there any other questions regarding passes on the rail side, if you want to bring up? Okay, if not, we're going to move on to bus. I know this has been a long meeting, but we need to kind of at least get through this list. There are a number of suggestions here. I would point out, especially there was a proposal for a $2 fare. It's been significantly, or has been reduced to $1.80. But let's start from the top. Are there any questions regarding the increase of the regular fare by 10 cents? Yes, Mr. Downey.
I think it would be helpful in explaining this to point out that this will be one of the lowest bus fares in the country.
Yep.
That's true. Moving on to the 7-day regional pass, there's been a slight increase in that fare. Any questions there? Under Metrobus, I'm sorry. Yes. Yeah, the bus pass. And then we also have changes in the cash boarding fare for local limited stops at $1.80 and cash boarding fares for express at $4. Any questions or comments regarding these bus fares? Mr. Bolger.
I wanted a clarification on the bus increase of 10 cents. Is that, just help me out, is if bus to bus, what happens on the transfer? Is that still okay?
On the transfers,
so you go
they
bus
haven't
to,
changed.
Bus to bus transfer?
No change on that.
All right, so within a two-hour bus schedule time frame, it's you can make the transfer without an additional fare bump. Okay, how about bus to rail? Yeah, Delta, the 50 cents increase. Which?
No, transfer cost remains at 50 cents. There's no increase on the rail to bus, the bus to rail transfer. Sorry.
Right.
Yeah. Right. I'm sorry, discount. Did I say increase? I didn't mean that.
Let's read.
Yeah. When you enter the rail system or if you go onto the bus.
the 50 cents.
Using the smart card?
Yes. Okay. Have to be, yes. Transfers require smart card.
Thank you.
Any other questions regarding Metrobus fares in terms of this proposal? Then moving on, we will move, if you flip to the next slide, Metro Access. The recommendation here is no change to the fare methodology with a fare cap remaining at $7. I know we'll probably have a few questions here. We'll start with Mr. Downey, then Ms. Porter.
And certainly this was what we heard most at the hearings, and retaining the $7 I think is a positive step. I just wanted to clarify in my mind two other issues that have come up. One, I think Mr. Green did explain that we will have a system that allows you to book an off-peak trip and get paid for, charged for an off-peak trip, which is something we heard at the hearings. Yes. We're then told it couldn't happen, but evidently it needs looking at.
We are doing the fare calculator, and actually we're scheduled to demo that to the accessibility community in May.
Yeah, the point was that once you book it, you're set.
Yes, and once you book that, so it's actually...
Once you book it, that's it. Unlike the airlines, you'll pay what you book.
Yeah, no.
With no extra charge for baggage.
No.
And the other point which came up in the hearings, and I think you had a footnote on the table, but the table indicates a 28% increase in revenue for Metro Access, but I gather that is budget to budget. It is not actual to actual. We're not looking to get 28% more revenue out of the users. It's just we overestimated or underestimated what we'd be getting this year.
That's correct.
Okay, Ms. Porter.
I just want to agree with Mr. Downey's comments and also to ask if we can make a commitment. We talked about different ways of calculating Metro Access fares, and the issue was that we couldn't do what we needed to do between the time it came up and the budget consideration to look at some of those options. And I wonder if we can get a commitment to look at some of those options between now and the next time we look at the budget.
Any other questions regarding Metro Access, Ms. Hines?
Mr. Costa, I'm going to wander in the weeds here for just a minute so that I'm sure I understand what this calculator thing actually means for the person and how it will actually work. So I go online. Mm-hmm. I put in, I'm going from here to here. Mm-hmm. I say I want to be picked up at 9:30. To get to my 10:25 appointment or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then it calculates my fare the same way that when I go to the trip planner and I'm trying to figure out when do I have to go to Clarendon to get to Metro Center.
Yeah, so you'll have a rail, a trip planner, bus, but it'll also have an additional access.
Okay, so I've now been told whatever my fare is, and what you're telling me is that's locking my fare in?
That's not necessarily locking your fare. When you call to make the reservation to have your 9:30 trip prepared, that is what's locking in your trip. We went an extra step and made the trip planner available to the for the access community so they can actually validate that as well.
But what do I have as an individual that I can carry with me that says, this is what my fare is? Do I have anything? Because one of the things we've been hearing is that people are told their fare is X, and then they get in the vehicle, and the fare is different.
Well, they would have the trip planner.
So are they to print out their trip planner?
They could print out
their
trip planner.
I really want us to figure out how we give that customer assurance that the price they saw
sure.
is the price they're going to pay.
I understand.
He's behind you.
So what we'll do, I know. I'll have Christian answer this, but the trip planner will work as that, but I understand your issue.
But
Well, good morning. Yes, we certainly heard that question a number of times from customers. Right now, what customers get is a verbal confirmation of what the fare is at the time of reservation. Whenever we have a fare dispute after the fact and someone calls customer service, one of the things we can do, at least to make sure for a sanity check, is that we do have the calls, the reservation calls are recorded. So we're able to verify what their customer requested and what the agent quoted at the time. The fare does not change, though, after that quoted fare is given. And another thing I think is important to add is that when that fare is given, it's based on the time the customer requested, regardless of whether we negotiate it to fit it into our schedule. We have a 30-minute tolerance around the requested time to fit the trip onto the schedule. But the actual fare is tied to the time the customer requested.
Okay, so if I feel I've been mischarged as a rider, I then have to call, I have to complain, you have to review the tape, and so I have to really go out of my way. What I'm really asking for is, can't we give them something that they carry with them so that there's not an argument?
So I think we're going to go back, and we're in the development of the trip fail calculator. And the reason to demo it to the access community is to get their input. And I believe probably one of their inputs might be the comments that you're suggesting. And so we'll make sure that we can actually have them, give them the capability maybe to print something out from that trip planner in order to address that. So the purpose of that May meeting is to get those comments.
All right. Well, I'd really like you to report back to the board on this particular issue. Because I just think we need a way to not make it onerous if something goes awry, but to just sort of end that conversation.
Yeah, sure. I do think some of this is iterative, like the other discussions that the board has had this morning about present versus future capabilities. You know, obviously the fare calculator is going to be a web-based application. We have started to move into the territory of email correspondence with customers who have it. Customers also have the ability to book Metro Access trips on the web, but again, that is all, you know, subject to their ability to do that. So, you know, the solutions we find for Metro Access have been iterative as we've been able to find different avenues to go to the customer where they're at and provide this capability. That's the nature of the research we've done.
Thank you.
Any other questions regarding Metro Access? Mr. Boulder?
Christian, all of us book online airline tickets, et cetera. So you said that the charge or the fare for Metro Access is when the call comes in versus when all of the machinery and the Googling of the schedule gets done. So that is that in, so if I call and that's when it starts, that's when the fare is set.
Right, that's correct.
Okay, so I say if I'm slow on the my laptop and I'm trying to figure out, you know, a different time, or I don't want to transfer like on a plane situation, and it takes me 20 minutes, and then I said I want it, or, you know, submit, it could change?
Well, no, we're talking about two different things. If a customer books the trip on the web, when they complete the reservation, the fare is shown on the screen. Customer knows that that's the fare, and that serves as the quoted fare, and that doesn't change. If the customer calls the call center to make a reservation, it's all verbal. So one of the things that we're trying to do with the fare calculator is essentially let the customer shop before they request the time, to find a time that corresponds with an affordable fare, and then when they call, they're going to ask for that fare.
And they'll be given that fare regardless,
yes, sir,
of when you show up to pick them up.
That's correct.
Any other questions or comments regarding Metro Access? Not, we'll move on to other. This includes a increase in parking fees at park and ride facilities by 25 cents, changing the reserve parking rates to the balance supply and demand, and also decreasing the bike locker rental fee to $220. Any questions here or comments? Mr. Downs.
It's not about reserve parking, but it is a comment that I think statistics show that on any given day, 8,000 Metro parking spaces are vacant. Is that about right? We don't have any online capacity in real time to show where there are actually, at that moment, vacant spaces within the system. So it's really hard to market this product. And like an airline seat, after the day is gone, that product has it has no value. We have a resource that is supposed to be not only providing a service but a revenue stream. Marketing this capacity better helps build that revenue stream and utilize that resource. You can online find out where every parking space is available at BWI, for instance. It is not rocket science, and we need to do much better about not only thinking about pricing that product that is vacant to reflect an incentive for the utilization of it, but also just information for people who want to access the system by finding a parking space. It's got to be on the agenda about information systems for these users. On decreasing the bike locker rental fee to $120, I think that's a great idea, and I'm totally in support of it. I wish there was a parallel growth in capacity here. The highest demand access mode with wheels is the increasing demand for bike access at Metrorail stations, and it's not just enough to reduce the price of the lockers and the racks. It's increasing the capacity at the same time you're reducing the price. And I don't think there is a parallel capital commitment that would match the $120 price.
Well, the reduction in the price is really to better align the capacity that's available with demand. We've not embarked on increasing the number of lockers. It's more racks and even, I forget what we call it, the cages that people can do it. So we've looked at that, gone through that, and have before us a plan to move in that direction where the demand is, increase capacity.
And Mr. Bulger?
Look, just for the record, I think we should be out of the bike business. We should give this to Capital Bike Share, ask them, and have a set up a meeting for next budget cycle. You know, Henny Youngman, take my bike racks. They're doing a great job. It's like tulips in Washington. There's bikes everywhere downtown in Arlington. They're going to be in Montgomery County soon. And if you haven't seen the bikes share program, you really have missed a great, great success story. Their numbers are unbelievable. So for future reference, that's where I think we need to explore that possibility.
All right. Mr. Dyke.
Just wanted to note for the record, if we decide to move on Tom's recommendation about the 7,000 vacant parking spaces, yeah, if you could move some of those out to Vienna, I'd greatly appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, any other questions about this list? And okay, and then we'll spend a few moments on Title VI. Any questions or comments? Mr. Downey?
Comment on Title VI. For those who don't know what Title VI is, it is Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. It's our obligation as we take actions to look at any disparities that are created. I take it very seriously. Those of you who were with us a couple of weeks ago when we met with the Federal Transit Administration heard a very strong message from their administrator, their deputy administrator, and their chief counsel that they are taking it seriously. There is a rulemaking pending that may change the nature of the analysis that's required. That is not yet in effect. Obviously, they cannot implement a rule that has not been yet finalized, and hopefully it will be finalized in a way that makes it workable. But they are not backing off on concern for how we go about this. One thing I think that would help in this regard, all we see here is a simple statement that says, we've looked at it and there are no problems. The resolution says the same thing. I believe that in, just as we do with environmental, we should see the backup. We should know what those impacts are. Much of the discussion here this morning had to do with the issue of disparate impact. So I would like, before I vote for the fare increase, to really get my hands into what has been done. And then secondly, that we take this seriously in a way that we link certain actions that we're now proposing in a way that says we listened, we analyzed, here's the reason we're making these changes, and that we document that. This should not simply be a check-the-box exercise. It should be a tool in our really carrying out what is our responsibility as decision makers on the fares.
I just stress that. we will provide the board with a report before the board meeting when the board decides on what the fare adjustments are. If you elect to prove this, then we can provide that report. A lot of the work has been done. This organization takes this very seriously, too. This is our Title VI plan, which has been approved by the FTA for 2011-2014. It lays out all our procedures. It lays out how we've addressed Title VI in the past and how we, under the current rules, will address it here. So it is taken very seriously. There's a lot of analytical work done. That simple statement there, which is based only on preliminary analysis, only because this is preliminary, will be turned into a document which we can deliver to you by the board meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Sarles. Any other comments regarding the Title VI analysis? Okay. What I'd like to do is I'm going to attempt to do something here. Recap kind of where I think we're at, and then in terms of a sense of the committee, and I have a couple of questions regarding Peak of the Peak and rail passes again. I believe I think there's general consensus regarding the Metro bus fares as proposed, based on the lack of questions that were raised. I think there's consensus on the Metro Access proposal, as well as the other charges. I think I heard some debate regarding the Peak of the Peak fare, and the question I want to ask is, for those who have expressed some concern still about the Peak of the Peak fare as proposed, what additional information do you require or discussion that we need to have in order to make a decision on this or not? I mean, in terms of your comfort level. And in terms of moving this forward. So that's a question. I know there's, you know, this has been debated, but I'm just trying to get us to a point where we understand kind of what it will take to move this package forward.
I keep seeing eyes looking in my direction. but I think what you're asking is, are there any other questions? On the table is the recommendation of eliminating it. So if it's yes, we have a consensus. If not, what are the additional questions? Is that
right,
what you're
right.
asking? Okay. I have no additional questions.
I'd say for me, initially, I did have concern about Peak of the Peak really tied to revenue issues. But the deeper discussion has given me a different sense. So I'm certainly prepared to support the recommendation at this point.
Mr. Nichols.
I'm certainly prepared to support the recommendation, but I am a broken record that it is, I want the context of the decisions that we make and the consensus that we achieve around revenue in all respects be understood in the context of what it means for next year and the next year and the next year. And I, before we close out the discussion today, whether it's at this moment or at the next segment at your discretion, Mr. Chair, I want to have that discussion about what we are expecting, when we will receive it, and how it will be, how we will be able to use that for the benefit of the system and particularly for our jurisdictional funders to have a clear sense of the long view. And we haven't done that well historically. as an agency, we haven't done it at all. And it's a stake in the ground for me, and I believe it is for the board, as we've talked about this in the past. But we need to bring clarity to when that will happen as we make decisions. And I need that discussion. I support the package, but I need that discussion. I need to have that on an urgent basis.
Mr. Sarles?
We'll be prepared at the next Finance Administration Committee to have that discussion in multi-year funding. And multi-year expenses, and what's impacting it.
Ms. Hudgens? Okay, Mr. Dyke.
I just want to associate myself with what Alvin said about the long-term discussion and the need to, even though I still have discomfort with taking money out of the budget at this point, I will certainly support that if that's the consensus of the board, with the commitment that we take a long look at what we're doing in the out years and realize that at some point we're going to have to step up and make some very tough decisions, and it may involve obviously more increases in the future.
Mr. Costa.
Ms. Hines.
This has been really a fascinating couple of months. I think so many of us are new, and last year we were able to close our gap without going to the riders, which I think we were all very proud of, because the riders had experienced a major increase in fiscal year 10. And one of the questions that was asked in the survey that Barbara reported to us earlier was, who should pay? And the answer kind of came back, you know what, it should be shared, and the actual percentages results that were reported was the taxpayers of the jurisdiction should carry about 51% and the riders should carry about 48%, which is pretty close to 50-50, right? One of the great challenges, which other people have referred to today, is the fact that we have been approaching this as a two-year cycle. And so you can look at this year and you can say, we're pretty close to the split that the riders talked about. And if you take the $2 million that we pre-approved for bus, we're even closer to that split that the riders talked about. But there was last year when the jurisdiction stepped up 100%. And there may be next year when the jurisdictions step up 100% if we stay with our two-year cycle. And so this multi-year business plan and this multi-year budgeting, which we've been talking about for about a year now, becomes more and more critical in managing expectations as we move forward. And I think that is our challenge. And I think that, what Alvin's asked for and other people have mentioned, I personally, and I appreciate, you know, next month we're going to start talking about this in earnest, but when this budget is approved 2 weeks from now, if that's where we end up being, I think we need an accompanying statement from the board that puts a number of these things that we've talked about today into that context of, as we move forward, these are areas we've already identified we have to explore, whether we're talking about passes or some of these other things. But we also have to begin to frame up this cycle that we hope of building with the riders, so that we're not back here, 2 years from now, having the same conversation, that we've managed our expectations and we frame the issue not only around CPI, but around the issue of what the jurisdiction, everybody who lives in a jurisdiction is supporting versus what the rider, the user fee actually is. So, on behalf of my jurisdiction, we are happy to be supporting this proposal from the manager. We share the concerns that other people have raised, but given where we are and given the conversation we've had, I think this is the appropriate thing to do at this point in time, but we have to frame ourselves better for moving forward.
Any other comments? I would like, and I second your statement. Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry, Muriel.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to quickly get in, and I appreciate, Mr. Acosta, your work in moving this discussion. I found it to be very helpful from our point of view, and I have been encouraged by the general manager's amendment to his proposal, which I think addressed quite a lot of the concerns that I had as a district representative moving into this discussion. I think that the increases on the bus fares had been a particular concern of ours, and I appreciate that we have addressed the cash boarding price as well as, you know, a modest increase on the smart trip. And I think that's important for quite a lot of our people, even more people who are riding the bus. Also think that landing on the $1 surcharge for off-peak fares makes a lot more sense to us, and it sounds like it also makes sense to the people who participated in the survey. We spent a lot of time thinking about the passes, and we'll have to go with your recommendation on the pricing for the one-day pass, and I think I share the concerns for that others have presented about getting to a discount price on a monthly pass, but I would emphasize the need for a short trip pass on Smart Trip, and the sooner we get to that, the better. On the peak of the peak, I am prepared today to vote it out of committee. I would spend some time over the next couple of weeks seeing if there are other things that could benefit riders before I would commit to that finally. But I want to thank you for that. And lastly, I know we haven't gotten to it, but we do show 55, and I know that the general manager has identified $10 million in cuts, which we appreciate you going through and scrubbing it, but that's still a net of, with the system improvements and the Dulles plan, that's $55 million, so $45 million in new spending, which for the district represents an additional $15.8 million that our taxpayers are being asked to come up with. So we certainly take that request very seriously, and we'll also take that into consideration moving forward. Thank you.
Ms. Porter?
Assuming that we are now talking about all of the Metro Rail issues, I wonder if we could get a sense of if we reduce the 7-day rail pass and the 28-day rail pass by 5%, whether you could give us a sense of how much revenue would be lost if we did that. That takes the 7-day pass down to about $54.75 and the 28-day pass down to $218.50. Since relatively few people use it now and likely fewer would use it if there's not a discount in it, and since it's a considerable increase over the percentage on the 7-day pass now, I have a hard time thinking that it would be an enormous amount of revenue.
That would reduce revenue, the fare box revenue by $5 million. So, in your example, I would just assume it would be a $2 million hit to fare box revenue. But that's a broad statement. We'd have to go back and analyze it.
Are you looking at the implications of raising it? Are you looking at the people who buy fare passes now, or are you looking at people who would likely buy it if you raised the fares?
I would have no basis for new riders. I would think the basis of my analysis is that people would be, existing riders would move to that product. It's not new riders would come.
No, I'm thinking that all the existing riders will not move to that product.
Okay, right. Yeah, right. I would think that there's a portion. So my statement of a $5 million loss on the 10% discount example is not all the riders. It's a portion of the riders. We made some analysis, I think, that said out of 800,000 riders, 300,000 are smart benefit users. They wouldn't buy that pass. So that would leave 500,000 riders, of which maybe 100,000 riders would. And so I'm saying this from memory, but based on that example, and if we discounted the pass by 10%, we are assuming we would lose $5 million in fare box revenue. So if we took your example, it would just be half of that. So we would have a $2 million lower fare box revenue that we would have to recover by a subsidy. So.
Okay.
Any other comments? I'm going to make a statement and let's see if this works. I know there are a number of questions that have been put on the table. I think there are some concerns about how this, if we commit or if we have consensus on this fare package, what it means in the future. There are a lot of great proposals and ideas that were stated in terms of how we should follow, for instance, on the pass. There may be a couple of questions about peak of the peak that we still need to answer, and if staff could prepare that prior to the board meeting, that probably would be helpful. But my sense is there's general consensus in terms of what we see here in terms of a package for FY13 in terms of fare changes. Am I correct? Am I incorrect at stating that? Okay. So I think we have consensus on this fare package. I know that, and it would be helpful if staff could also prepare a summary of the issues, for instance, on the past and other things that we do need to follow up on in terms of our business planning and in subsequent discussions about, you know, fares in the future. And I think a lot of interesting ideas, again, were posed. And we don't want to lose it, and we don't want to start from scratch again. So I think as we start our strategic planning discussions up again, I think those need to go on the table. But my sense is we have consensus on this. Okay. So I think we can move forward. There are also two other pieces. I think the subsidy table was put up on the screen and part of the presentation. Are there any questions or comments about that?
Mr. Acosta.
Excuse me.
I would just say that there are a couple issues that Arlington is still working.
Okay.
And so we think we're close. I'm looking at our staff. But there's been some ongoing conversation, particularly related to bus, that I don't think is resolved yet. So that's a caveat. I think it only would affect Virginia.
That's the same comment here. I think when we resolve that, that should resolve. When you resolve your issue, hopefully, we will know in time to know how it impacts the rest of Virginia.
So we can find before the next board meeting.
Before the board meeting.
Okay. Mr. Downs and then Mr. Nichols.
Just a question of clarity. If we have a consensus about the fair framework, we've had no real discussion about the vehicle that carries this, and that is the budget. What is the expectation from the Finance Committee standpoint about when we have the serious discussion about the overall budget framework?
In terms of the FY13 budget? For this budget.
For this coming budget. There are issues that need to be better ventilated than simply a discussion of the fare structure.
I agree. Well, I was trying to get
us. We're doing this, I know, because of the time frame about implementing the fares by the 1st of July, which I think is a totally rational approach. But it does mean that we are, for right now, we are separating the fare decisions from the overall budget discussion about what we're buying with those funds. I think it's okay and it fits within a sequence, but I'm curious about what we're saying publicly about when we're going to have the Finance Committee have a detailed, structured set of conversations about the meat of this budget proposal.
So go ahead, Ms. Kissel.
Okay, so I'll try, and Mr. Acosta can jump in, but we've, to some extent, have had a lot of discussion on the $1.6 billion budget and the general manager's budget as proposed since January. Certainly can provide more discussion on that at the Finance Committee here, but it's been very detailed in terms of some of the bus improvements, the fatigue management improvements, some of the other transit police improvements that we have included in the baseline budget, that it impact the service to our riders, and we've indicated that since January. We've had discussions on it February and March. So I think that I think that it's necessary to have both discussions to move the fare proposal, as well as to move the budget, and as you indicated, Mr. Downs, to have additional questions on that larger budget if they're still open, because I think they go hand in hand. I agree.
I guess I'm going to be a little bit more open and just put it on the table. I think what Mr. Downs is saying is that because there has not been a full discussion now, and we have had a full discussion, that is, each element that was produced in the proposed budget, the only differences that you see are predominantly the fare changes, and maybe and the initiatives, the changes that the general manager made, which I assume brings the budget back into balance. And if there are no questions regarding that, then we would move forward. But if there needs to be a rediscussion of those, I think it means that we could not get there on the 26th. That's my understanding here. But
I thought we had a discussion at one point that we could have two separate actions about, one about fares, mm-hmm. the other about budget adoption. The fares needed to be in advance so that they could actually be implemented in a timely fashion. I personally have several serious questions I'd like to raise about the operating budget for the coming year, including the now forecast about the staffing requirements for the Silver Line. I think we have not given ourselves enough time to have those kinds of discussions. If there is a suggestion that we have that as a special call Finance Committee meeting in advance of the board meeting, I'd be amenable to that. But I don't believe in this context that we have had an adequate discussion of the budget.
Well, the one suggestion I would have, if we cannot get there for the 26th, is that we could give the direction to staff about the fare increase and have any discussions at a subsequent Finance Committee meeting in May and then adopt the full budget. I say that subject to the fact that we're clear that the framework of the budget is not changing in terms of fares after we do so today. And I think the remainder is the questions that need to be answered about the remaining part of the operating and capital budget. And maybe the statement I'd just like to make is I understand the timing that we're dealing with and the inability to discuss the entire budget unless we go much longer today in one sitting. But I think that the point is that what we're trying to accomplish is to set a new schedule of operation in this process, and that we can adopt a full budget in full and ample time to implement that budget, including the fare increase. And so they really need to come together. And I think we can accommodate them coming together. If we can't get there by next Thursday the 26th, is to accommodate it by getting there in May. With clarity is that we've already looked at the fare and we are not going back on that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think one of the other key things is if we could put on the table today what those questions are that you would like to address at the subsequent meeting, it would probably help us kind of get there. I think you raised one about the Silver Line staffing. There may be other questions, but I think in order to help us prepare.
Pension system requirements.
Okay. Other?
Collective bargaining.
Assumptions.
So I think we need more discussion on the expenditure side. I am very doubtful that we'll be adding money. If we actually come up with less, there will be a way to deal with that. But I think we should take more time, and I'd like to see that in a context where we've begun to look beyond 2013. If we could do that, I would work hard to get that done in May if we could do that.
Okay. So if I can make a suggestion then, there is a resolution in front of us which talks about all three pieces. Perhaps we could consider an amendment taking out the budget adoption from this with the understanding that this will give the staff clear direction in terms of how to proceed with fare changes. As they pointed out earlier, it does take some time to kind of begin that process. There is a slight risk if we adopt this, that that may have to change, hopefully not. But, and I do think the board should have, the committee should have another full discussion in May regarding expenses and all those relative points that Mr. Downs and Mr. Downey brought up. And if you have additional questions that you want to put on that, the next committee meeting agenda, feel free to let us know, and we'll make sure that is covered. But it would be helpful to get that sooner than later so staff could do that. So that would be my suggestion. Mr. Nichols, did you have a question?
I think the comments that I was going to raise have been most largely discussed by Mr. Downs, Mr. Downey, and others. And I'm very supportive of that approach. I think the messaging particularly is, as you summarized, that we've wrestled with, and I think this has been a very healthy dialogue in terms of the fare structure and what we are looking forward. But I do believe that the essential elements of the budget, I think we've really worked through as well, too. But those key points that were identified here are ones that I'm particularly interested in, particularly the context of this current budget in the context of the out years. What are the budget implications for that? I do have concerns around the staffing issues, the ramp up and the personnel that are a substantial driver of the cost, and not only the real cost, but our capacity to achieve that pace of ramp up. And what are the implications of that if we achieve it or don't achieve it in terms of system performance? And what are the measures that we're going to put in place to actually hire 1,000 people? I mean, that's an enormous, and I'm not necessarily looking for that answer today, but I know it's an enormous undertaking. That is something that we have never done, and not many organizations hire that many people that quickly. So it's one aspect of it that I'd like to discuss, and I want to commend the staff, general manager and his team, for the quality of today's discussion and how you prepared for it. I do think it's been very healthy and well done, and I appreciate the challenges that you have in doing that. Last comment, if I could, and that is that it's just a personal bias of mine, but I think that one of the things for me is to try to reshape some of the dialogue. We put a lot of emphasis on subsidy. We recognize that what comes in the fare doesn't pay for the entire operation. And for me, it really needs to take on a tone of an investment as opposed to a subsidy, because the region is investing in an infrastructure that supports the economic vitality of this region. And so it is very important that we frame this in terms of how much investment is required by the region to support the system. It's not a subsidy, it's a requirement, because it's an investment that we need to have to make the economy work. And I think that's a healthy part of the dialogue that we need to inject. A lot of our riders, we think in terms of customers, we have to provide for them whether they respond to a survey or not. We've got to evaluate and understand their needs and requirements, because our employers depend upon it, their livelihoods depend upon it, and it doesn't matter whether they respond to a survey or not, whether they like a price increase or not, or whether the jurisdiction likes a subsidy increase or not. The reality is we've got to figure out how to run the system, what it's going to cost to run it, to be able to accurately convey that information, including who it impacts and who it impacts the most, and then be as transparent and accurate about it as possible. But it is an investment. It's not a subsidy. It's not something you can choose not to do, because the system requires it, or either we have to shut it down. And we're not prepared to do that, and the economy is not either. So I think we need to be more clear about what it is that we're asking of our riders and of our jurisdictions. It's an investment to make the system function and to function well. Thank you. It's my high horse. I'm sorry.
Ms. Hudgens?
In 2 weeks, I will go to the table to balance the budget in Fairfax County. And I think that the key here that I have a great empathy for Mr. Nichols' viewpoint, that we really need clarity, and we need to let our riders and other stakeholders know that it is that commitment that you're making from the jurisdictions. The jurisdictions are different right now. And I think the point that we have to make here is that we sit around the table and we've had great discussion and we've had an enormous amount of commitment to what we believe the system is about and what our commitments should be in order to continue and to grow it. We need that uniformity in funding. And I would urge us all to take that message back, because that is what we struggle with. My struggle is a lot different than yours. And I say that because it is hard, but I've kind of bulked the system in saying, we're going to increase our subsidy because we think the system is important. But I'm doing it on the backs of a very narrow perspective. And I think that has to be recognized. I didn't opine it earlier because the customers told us that. They said we need a dedicated, consistent funding source. And we all can have that discussion, and I think we should have that discussion here, because it's only with that discussion here that it can begin to take it back to all of the stakeholders that are partnering in this to make it happen. Otherwise, I'm not a sourpuss here, but we're going to always have the same kind of discussion that we've had today about customer impact and subsidy impact until we decide there is a consistency of a funding source that we can all tie our hands together and gather around and do it. Because we can't keep telling people how great it is, but we don't understand to take the message back that it's great because there's an inequity and sacrifice. So I'd have to say that without any sense of a lack of commitment from people, but we have to have a full discussion if we're going to make those comments that we've made earlier today.
Mr. Hudden. Mr. Bolter.
Well, I just wanted to associate myself with what Catherine says about, and what you said, Alvin, about, you know, what this means to the region and more things, you know, than we can ever get our arms around. I don't look at it as a subsidy. I know it gets characterized that way. I look at it as an investment by all parties. But I think we talked about this before. We need to agenda the question of long-term stable financing for some, after we get through this budget cycle, maybe at this summer, before we get overwhelmed again with what I call lots of things that come at us all at once. I had one final thing I wanted to ask about, which is kind of connected, that I don't know the answer to, and maybe you all, Carol, could, or Rich. When we look at the jurisdiction's contribution for the investment, when will that be adjusted for the census? And since we now have had the census from 2010 and now we're in 2012, and what's the latest on when that will be down to the urbanized area blessing?
We expect to get the urbanized area for the census this summer, and so it'll be a big part of the FY14 and beyond plan. Oh, once we receive that, and I check on it every week, we're just interested, because we can do, we're actually looking to do that to bake it into some of our multi-year plans that we're doing, so we will keep you apprised of that.
Thank you. So before us again is a resolution, and that basically adopts the staff report on the public hearings in terms of the summary. Also, that would adopt the fair structure for FY2013 as proposed. And this resolution also contained language that also adopted the budget. So I assume if we take that out, Ms. O'Keefe can rewrite this in a way that that will take out all pertinent language that reflects the adoption of the FY13 budget. Before we move on, I'd like to thank the committee for this discussion. It's been an important discussion. This is core to what a board does. It's to adopt a budget and to deliberate on the consequences for the agency. And we've heard a lot of good comments from various committee members here. And I think that's an important thing about this whole process. And again, I think raising fares is always a difficult proposition. We certainly understand, as you heard today, the impacts on our customers, and we hope to see before the board receives the final resolution at the board meeting, the full Title VI information. So we certainly, as Mr. Downey said, so we certainly understand the implications on our ridership and our most vulnerable riders. So I think that's a very important thing. But again, So I'd like to. I would entertain a motion to present.
The public hearing process, and then to approve the recommendations on fares.
Well, and this resolution was basically all on one. So what I guess my point was, we would remove the language that pertains to the adoption of the budget itself, and we would let staff remove that prior to the time it comes to the board. So I was basically putting that on the table in terms of what a revised resolution would do. So I guess I just made a motion.
I seconded.
Okay. So any other questions or discussions before we
What are we doing with Tom's suggestion about dealing with, are we dealing with that before the budget vote?
We're not voting on the budget.
So when is the budget discussion happening?
It will be at the next committee meeting in May. What we're doing today is adopting the fare structure. We put off or deferred a decision on the FY 2013 budget because we want to talk about the expense side, basically. And also we haven't adopted the capital budget either as part of it. So this is basically just to put into motion the fare package so staff has directions in terms of making changes. So,
but when would the board be voting on the fare proposal?
At the next board meeting on the 26th.
So that's not then responsive to Tom's suggestion that we have the budget discussion prior to.
My suggestion was, given the time constraints about implementing the fare increase, that we make a decision about fares in time to be able to have them effective on the 1st of July, which would mean a consideration by the board on the 26th, and then next month have a debate on the full outlay budget.
I was just told by Lloyd that we need to mark up this resolution. So if you would just give me a moment, and then I'll. I just want to make sure it's fine with Carol before I move forward since we're making a change. Okay. We're trying to unbundle this.
I'm just going to delete the last three whereas. The last three results. Yeah. Or excuse me, results. Yeah.
Okay.
So
we'll get, this is okay, leave it there? The District of Columbia student fare increase?
That's part of the fare.
Okay.
That's part of the fare.
So it's just basically the last three.
The last three.
Okay. All right. All right, so we have it here. Okay.
Well, the motion that's on the table is that we approve the resolution as amended with the removal of the last three resolves. And that's the motion.
That's basically it.
Not the last one.
Yeah. Remove the last three resolves on page 57.
Not the last one.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Let me read out kind of the resolves that we're eliminating so we're clear. The first one is resolves that the Board of Directors approves the FY 2013 operating budget of $1.5 million with operating revenues, expenses, and subsidies as detailed in attachment C and D, and be it further resolved that the 103-mile rail construction debt service portion of FY 2013 budget totals $60.2 million and is allocated to the jurisdictions as detailed in attachment E. And the final piece that would be eliminated from this resolution is resolved that the $21.2 million of debt service expenditures resulting from the issuance of Metro Matters bonds are subsumed within the FY 2013 budget. Those would be eliminated from the resolution in front of you. This is what would be amended. Everything would remain the same. All right. Thank you. So, so I made the motion. Do we need to second it again?
No.
Okay. Go ahead.
We are approving, or we are recommending this resolution absent those clauses that you suggest.
Yes.
And then would there be a second resolution that would be drafted and discussed in the context of the budget? Is
yes, there will be. There will be a set, after we have our discussion in May, the committee may consider another resolution that would adopt the 2013 operating budget. So this only deals with the fares. We stripped up all the provisions dealing with the operating budget. Any other questions or comments? Mr. Downey.
The third whereas with respect to Title VI, I think we either needs to be modified or at least understood that we will see the results of this analysis, not simply that we are told that it exists.
See, the board would see the results. So I would accept that as a friendly amendment and just require the just ask the staff to provide that information prior to the board meeting. So we'll include that as a friendly amendment to the resolution. Any other questions or comments? Hearing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.